Kelly from Shinedown. It's our number one song. It has been for 3 straight weeks. That's it for us.
Thanks to Ivan Moody for spending the last hour with us. And if you miss any part of the countdown, get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And you can download the free iHeartRadio app to listen to us no matter where you are. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
We'll see you next time.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Hi, Julene.
Hello, Peter.
Ready for another night?
Oh, I am always ready. I've been ready since 1 o'clock in the morning last week when we closed down that show.
Well, hey, this is a phone-in talk show, and we say that because usually WRIF is just playing great rock and roll all week long, 24/7,
yeah.
And they cut us 3 hours.
Yes, they do, yeah, and we are grateful for it.
Well, yeah, I hope you enjoyed as well. We'd like you to participate. You can call in and give your opinions, raise some subjects, or respond to what we say.
Yeah, and boy, do people have opinions these days.
They do.
They
do.
It seems like people are a little more vocal than ever.
I was thinking about, you know, I had so many things. All right, let me give the numbers first. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Yeah, one of the opinions I had, and is this the accident you related? Is that tellable on the air? Or
no.
We, no, okay. All right, sorry, folks. Didn't mean to do that to you. Yeah, I should have asked you before the show.
Yes.
But one
but
of the.
Had nothing to do with me, by the
no,
way.
No, I know. One of the, she fell off a bar stool again last night.
No, I didn't, actually. Yeah. I did do a live broadcast yesterday for St. Patrick's Day, but I was the only sober person in the room.
Well, you know, that is the observation I was going to make is that New Year's Eve, which used to be the traditional day night when people would just get blotto drunk, it was like embedded in the culture, that's gone.
Oh, well,
I think it's not 100% gone.
Exists, but I think people are.
And now the big drunk day is.
Is St. Patty's Day.
Yeah.
Well, that's been going on for a long time, too, Peter.
I know.
But, you know.
You know, when my father and grandfather, who are the Irish part of my family, on St. Patrick's Day, you know, which is, you think of Irish, you think of Catholic, but not entirely. Yeah. So my grandfather would send my father and my uncle to school wearing orange,
really?
Which is the sign of the Protestant, you know, who the Irish.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
that's
I did. And I said, what happened? He said, no, we got in some fights.
Oh, my gosh. That was kind of cruel.
Yeah.
Like setting your kid up for bullying. Yeah. Now these days it's totally reversed.
Well, they were tough. They were, my dad and my uncle Art were, they were kind of not real tall, but they
even
were
for a little guy. I was
they
going
were fighters.
To say.
They were boxers.
Were they really?
And my grandfather was actually a fight promoter.
I had no idea. You'd think after all these years, I'd know all your stuff.
He was here in Detroit. Pardon me. And he managed bantamweights and flyweights and fleaweights. I mean,
fleaweights.
Yeah. I mean,
never
I don't even know.
Heard of that.
I don't even think they have those categories anymore. That was back in the major day.
Oh, that's fun.
If you'd like to join us on Facebook, and we'd like you to like it, facebook.com/nightcall. And there's always new stuff. Jalene Jordan is doing an incredible job.
I try. You know, I'm a busy girl, but I really try to keep up on it. And I just posted an article that we want.
Yeah, by Robert Fisk.
Yeah, who is writes for The Guardian.
And I think this one, though, yeah, he does. This one's in The Independent, and he's talking about that massacre in Afghanistan. Actually, I was listening to this right-wing talk show host when I came in, and he was saying...
You always listen. You do this. You say this every week.
Well, I want to
a left-wing talk show.
I want to hear what they're saying. That's why, I always watch the news, which I, you know, like the network news, which I don't get much out of in terms of real information.
For
but
real,
but you know what whatever, you know, tens of millions of people are listening to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And this is Robert Fisk. Madness is not a reason for this massacre. Well,
this was the 38-year-old staff sergeant who massacred 16 Afghan civilians in the middle of the
night. Including 9 children.
And, you know, now they're coming out, including 9 children, most importantly, I say. Now they're coming out saying he had been drinking alcohol, which is against the rules and in a combat zone, and so they're trying to blame it on that, and that this is his fourth tour, I believe, and they're blaming it on that. And so Robert Fisk, go ahead.
Well, I'll let people go to the site.
Okay.
I mean, because what he's saying is all over the coverage is essentially that Staff Sergeant Robert Bales is the victim. He'd been sent on 4 tours. He had seen a Army comrade have his leg blown off the day before.
Oh.
He had suffered. Well, here's what Colonel Thomas W. Collins, an Army spokesman, says. Lots of soldiers have 4 deployments, and they're not accused of things like this. But if you can imagine being these Afghan, I mean, can you imagine having like a little town? I'm trying to think of Metamora in Michigan, and someone just walked from house to house and killed 16 people. And then you saw the coverage, and the coverage was all about how the shooter had suffered all this emotional hurt, and he'd been rejected as a kid.
Yeah.
And
these people are only numbers in the eyes of the media.
Yeah.
They don't have names. They don't have faces. They don't have any history.
On the other hand, this is just more fallout from Bush's war. Of all the people that have been killed, the Afghans, the Iraqis, the Americans, the other people in these coalition of the billing, as we used to call them.
Yeah.
You know, they essentially got paid by the U.S., to fight.
And even Bush's folks, his people, are one by one coming out and saying, you know, this was a bad thing.
And since the attacks of September 11, 2001, more than 100,000 soldiers out of almost half a million, more than half a million, the size of active duty Army at its height, have been deployed 3 or more times. So I don't know how to cut this. I mean, all monstrous crimes. I mean, and these are pretty common in the United States, as we've been getting at. I mean, everybody,
mass murders.
You know, he spilled my Pepsi, so I had to go out and kill his whole family, right?
Yeah.
And so people are acting out this rage, I guess. What else can you say it is?
I think that's it.
And how much could your common sense be? That twisted by alcohol, that you're going to go kill children?
Yeah.
You're going to go kill Afghan children?
I mean, people do some pretty stupid stuff when they're drinking. I mean, I'll raise my hand.
Yeah.
I've done some stupid things. But that is just unfathomable.
Speaking of stupid things.
Yeah, okay.
How about this?
You're welcome.
Yeah. By the way, if you'd like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, by the way, I'd like to say one thing, and I don't know, maybe this encourages the opposite. Team Night Call. You and I are in front of the mic, and Athena and Sarah answering the phones. They don't have anything to do with our political opinions, right?
I think they kind of dig him, though.
Well, I don't even want to put them in that. They may not.
Yeah.
That's not for public consumption.
Okay.
But, you know, their job is to prepare the podcast, to edit the interviews that I send over in this ragged form for them to do.
But mostly to talk to you guys and get you on the air.
Yeah, and it's not for you to, you know, if you don't like something Jalene says, get in the air and say it to us. Don't give them a hard time.
You know, it is a brutal job in there. It's where I started in 1998, and I used to get beat up pretty good in there because of you, Mr. Werby.
Well, no, so maybe it just goes with the territory.
I think it does. It does, but I think a gentle reminder once in a while.
But Sarah and Athena, it's just another reason why we appreciate you so much.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's been all these, God, when will they ever end?
No.
These Republican primaries. And Mitt Romney took Puerto Rico.
He did take Puerto Rico.
Or maybe it was because Rick Santorum
said that they need to learn to speak English.
Yeah.
What an asshat. This guy gets worse all the time.
Yeah, because he said it's a federal law And he said all the other states had to do that. Yeah, Michigan had to learn English before they got.
Oh, God.
But it probably was a lot of French speakers.
Here. Yeah, right. True. Yeah. And it's just astounding to me. It really is astounding the level this guy goes to get votes. It's just gross.
You know, the folks, the singer-songwriter who you insisted not very many people knew of and probably don't, Phil Oakes.
Yeah.
From the 1960s.
OCHS.
OCHS. They got a great documentary out about his life and all that. Incredible singer, very, very political songs.
Yeah.
And he had a song that he wrote during the Civil Rights Movement, and it was Mississippi, Find Another Country to Be Part Of.
That holds true today.
But I am happy that Mississippi exists.
Because we have something to base...
Well, I mean, a baseline for stupidity or something like that.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Well, hey, they did reject that personhood amendment. That would have made, as soon as a, what happened?
The egg and sperm.
Thank you.
Together.
I knew it was something like that.
Yeah, well, neither of us ever experienced.
I know a lot about the process, but the science is a little. But in any event, where were we here?
Mississippi.
Are we on the air yet?
We're 10 minutes in, Peter.
Yeah.
You're talking about Mississippi and you're glad they exist.
Yeah, I'm glad they exist because it's kind of like a magnet. For lunkheads.
So they all kind of go there?
Yeah, how would you like them if they were
born there?
They're spread equally among the rest of the states.
Yeah, well, that's
true. And then, you know, we got like 1/49th of them or something.
Right.
Here's what I'm thinking of particularly. In Mississippi, 52% of Republicans say Obama is a Muslim.
A Muslim?
Yeah, they don't say Muslim. They say Muslim. And 36% aren't sure. In other words, 88%
are on the fence about it.
Well, 88% either don't know that Barack Obama is a Christian
or think
he's a Muslim. So 12%.
I just the stupidity of these people and they want to keep that in their heads. I think they want to be angry. They want to be racist.
Well, yeah, I think it is.
I think they like it.
I think it is just race. Where, I think, do I have this? At the end of this article.
I'm so sick of these people.
Yeah, they ought to find another country to be part of.
Yeah.
Here, this by the Mark Carlin, K-A-R-L-I-N, who's the editor of BuzzFlash. And BuzzFlash.com, always a great place to be. He's talking about Mississippi, also the place where 52% of Republicans polled believe that President Obama is a Muslim. And he says, code word, he's black, and we don't like that one bit at all.
Exactly that's exactly what it is.
So, I mean, they're not that dumb. They're really that vile.
Hateful.
Hateful.
Yeah, they really, really
because,
are.
Because, I mean, for one thing, why in the world would it matter what his religion is? I mean,
Mitt Romney is a Mormon.
Muslim. Yeah. Oh, no. What is he?
He's a Mormon. He's an animal dog abuser.
I forgot I can't find my little thing in here about that. I read this every
Your
so
constitution?
Often.
Constitution?
My Constitution of the United States.
I have faith in you that you can find that, Peter.
This is supplied by the American Civil Liberties Union.
Oh,
here it is. And I always read this about the senators and representatives before mentioned and all members of the several state legislature and then also the president and all that shall be bound by oath or affirmation, which means that if you do not want to swear on a Bible or swear to God upon taking office, you can affirm to support this constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. No religious test ever shall be required. And yet these, I don't know, I call them lunkheads. I'm going to talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
Well, name-calling has kind of gotten a bad reputation among talk show hosts lately, right?
Yeah, it has, but lunkhead,
we could talk.
Lunkhead's pretty mild.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that a fishing term?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a lunker, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody and all the Republicans in Mississippi are sluts and prostitutes. I hope that makes sense to everybody.
Well, it's
that's what Rush Limbaugh called this woman, and he lost all his sponsors.
Yeah. But, well, he's now. What is it? Was it up to 100 sponsors?
140.
Is it really?
Yeah. But you know, you and I heard the same
My
broadcast.
God.
Yeah, people have just bailed on him, And some people have said, and our pal Tom Hartman, a nationally syndicated talk show host, he said, liberals, don't be so smug about this. This could be this big sword being wielded that all of these advertisers are going to say, why am I advertising on stations that alienate people? So don't worry about this. We just alienate a few of you for about 2 hours, right, or 3 hours, whatever. Whereas, you know, if you're running 24/7.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, the Mississippi heavily in the Republican column, something like, I think it was 80% or more of Mississippians voted for McCain and Palin.
Yeah.
And one of the things they hate is big government.
Oh!
They hate big government.
They don't even know what they're talking
yeah.
about. And you know, these people, how many are living
one of the poorest states.
One of the poorest states, one of the most uneducated states. Ugh.
But how about this? The state of Mississippi, this again, Mark Carlin in BuzzFlash.com, sucks up $2.73 in federal support for every dollar its residents pay in national taxes. I mean, is that clear? Does that need any explanation on the face of it?
I think it does need explanation because I had to think about it for a little bit.
Okay, so that means if they pay $10 million in taxes, say, or say $100 million in taxes. To the federal government.
Right.
They get $273 million back from the federal treasury.
Wow.
Right. So that means that you and I are subsidizing people in Mississippi.
Oh.
Now they're also real poor. So I don't have any real problem with that if the money's going to some place that helps people. But you'd think they'd be a little grateful.
Right? One would think.
And they wouldn't think the guy that's signing the checks, Barack Obama,
right.
they wouldn't think he's a Muslim.
Yeah.
88% of them or either think he's a Muslim or... aren't sure.
I've heard some radio interviews of these folks down there, and I got to tell you, it is frightening.
Yeah. So Mark Carlin says in the dog whistle language of the right wing, which means dog whistle means, you know, that's above human audio.
Oral. Hearing
yeah.
level.
Yeah. So it's what. So when you say he's a Muslim, what Mark Carlin said, essentially you're saying we don't like him because he's an African American.
Right.
But you don't say that out loud.
Why don't they point out the white half? Because he is half white.
Yeah. So he's half related to them. To all the people that think he's a Muslim.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, that makes the state where 66% of Republican voters believe in creationism an official welfare state.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The Mississippi state government run out of Jackson is a leech upon the U.S. government, but try telling that to Mitt Romney. While pandering for votes in Mississippi before the recent presidential primary, Romney decided, quote, if the federal government were run more like here in Mississippi, the whole country would be a lot better off.
Yeah.
And he writes, say what?
Say what? He is so vile. He's so slimy.
Romney, the man who would be president, is saying that Washington, D.C. should emulate a state propped up by federal subsidies, arguably the poorest and least educated state in the country.
George and Taylor wrote in and said, hello, Peter and Julene. Please remind us of President Reagan's launch of his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were killed. I mean, he was exploiting that situation.
Well, Republicans realized, this was the Southern strategy. When finally the Democrats realized that that ethically, politically, socially, they could no longer depend on the social base of the South because of its support for institutionalized racism in the form of segregation, that meant that all the racists, all the people that believed in white supremacy migrated to the Republican Party. And if you remember your history, that was where the three civil rights workers were essentially lynched. I mean, they were beaten with chains and then killed by the Neshoba County Sheriff, right?
Mm.
And
there's a movie, Mississippi
Burning. Yeah. And Ronald Reagan then launched his campaign in this little teeny town in Mississippi. Why in the world would he do that? Why wouldn't he go to, you know, some big city? Why wouldn't he even
New
go
York,
to Jackson,
Chicago,
Mississippi?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he wanted to show every Ku Klux Klanner, which is about 88% of the population, I guess,
really?
At least of the Republicans, that they were going to pick up the cudgel of white racism and white supremacy. And that's where it's lodged today. And that's the basis of it. And one of the things that happens is that if you can't think straight about race, you usually can't think straight about anything else. It's mm-hmm. a toxic emotional
state. Well, it takes over your daily life because really, where are you going to go when you're only going to see white people, period?
Yeah.
You know?
And if you think the president is a Muslim, and then you're going, and you're poor as hell.
Poisoned.
Yeah. And then you're going to, you know, you're poor as hell, but, you know, I'm going to vote for a Christian. That's all about, you know, that when
the first is about you at all.
Yeah. When they asked Mitt Romney, he said, would you be in favor of raising the minimum wage? And he said, oh, yeah, sure I am. And then he, like a day later, oh, no, I mean, I meant, no, I wasn't.
Right. And who was it that said, what did I read about someone who didn't even know what the minimum wage was? One of these cats.
One of them?
Yeah. I don't know.
At least Mitt Romney doesn't want to raise it. Ron Paul would like to abolish it.
Yeah, one of those half of the bad things about Ron Paul.
Let the free market determine wages. How would you like that, folks?
Yeah.
You think this, you know.
You think flow now.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're fighting every day for a living wage.
Right.
Now it would become less than, worse. You know, I mean, it's bad.
Well, here, I don't know why I have this in this pile. I have things, you know, like grouped together. This is this family that disrobed Pennsylvania.
This was in
Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. Four family members were arrested after stripping naked outside a suburban Philadelphia high school and chanting, God is great. And these weren't Muslims who often chant that, God is great. These were Christians. And Police Superintendent Michael Chitwood says investigators don't know why 44-year-old Sarah Butler, man, this type is so
and
small.
Three of her children.
Yeah.
23-year-old Joanne Butler, 22-year-old Bessie Butler,
and 14-year-old son decided to disrobe.
Yeah.
He says the mother had gone there around 10 a.m. demanding to see a student. After she was denied, Chitwood said the family lay on the ground and began chanting, eventually shedding their clothing. Chitwood says the adults will be charged with defiant trespass, disorderly conduct, and open lewdness.
Oh.
And besides, just another example of how wacky religion makes people. You know what I say? Free the butlers. I mean, when you think about this, what in the hell is this all about? I mean, why would they be arrested for it? Defiant trespass? Why is it disorderly conduct to take off your clothes in public? And why is it open lewdness? I mean, that the body somehow.
It's like it's shameful.
Yeah, it's shameful. So free the butlers, huh? I mean, is there any reason? Is there any reason?
I think they're highly entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, is there any reason why people shouldn't be able to just walk down the street naked? I wouldn't.
No. And, you know, look at in Europe and other parts of the world where nudity is not looked upon that way. I mean, I'm telling you, when I was in Denmark on regular television, there was so much TNA going on. And I'm not a prude at all. I was even a little shocked.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things we're going to talk about. I've got a couple of people calling already. Kirk from Westland and Mike from Fenton. We're going to get you on the air in just a minute. Our number is 313-298-WRIF. I don't know. Free the butlers? Anybody think? People will say, what if children see an adult walking around naked? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you're going to look like eventually.
Yeah. You know what? This comedian from the 50s, Lenny Bruce.
Oh, sure.
Lenny Bruce, he said the reason that parents don't want kids to see pornography is they're afraid they'll grow up and do the same thing that they're watching. You know, I like have sex. So I don't know. I mean, I suppose there's some rules.
I'm being weird.
I don't know. You know, because almost all societies have some degree of modesty. There's very few.
Right.
A lot of tribal people in warm climates, oftentimes the women, you know, don't wear upper garments.
Yeah.
But in the main. I'm being ridiculous.
Free the butlers.
Free the
butlers. You just don't like anyone to be stifled.
But yeah, right, but free the butlers. That was like, they were making a statement.
They were making a serious statement.
I have no idea what the statement was.
I don't know, that they're crazy.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
They're nuts, Peter.
I'm trying to think. Well, let me raise one other thing, and then we'll get to the calls at 313-298-WRIF. Now, are you ready for this? College students, people planning to go to college.
Oh, this is not good.
They are talking about doubling the new student interest rates. Yeah.
And it's like 3-something.
3.4 to 6.8.
That's
doubling.
That's terrible.
And the Republicans, naturally, are saying, you know, we have to raise it or we got to cut something else.
That's terrible.
Yeah. It is. This will be for new loans.
New loans starting in June, I think it is. It's already this. We talk about debt due to student loans and the epidemic that it is now. My gosh.
Yeah, the suits against people that have defaulted on their loans has doubled. And it is that, well, let me just read a little of this. Millions of college students could be in for a shock this summer when the interest rate on a popular federally subsidized student loan doubles unless Congress acts. Now, that's a whole problem itself, you know, that the government is subsidizing these loans. So again, it's rich people, that's who loans money for us to buy houses or cars or go to college or what have you, with these usurious rates. In other words, 6.8, come on, you can get cars for like what, 1.5 and stuff like that. And the whole idea that students are saddled with this debt is just unconscionable.
Yeah.
And it says college students on Tuesday, now this is pretty good. I'll tell you why I think it's only pretty good. Delivered more than 130,000 letters to congressional leaders asking them to stop rates from increasing, from doubling. The rate hike affects new subsidized, what's called Stafford loans, which goes to low and middle income undergraduates. So middle class and lower income people, are they going to be the ones with the high rates? Well, naturally. They hope to raise enough awareness to get Congress to stop it. Now, I wasn't going to read this, but this is Tyler Dowden. He's a freshman at Northern Arizona University. He says, I will be put back into buying a house and saving up for my expenses later in life. And life, as we know it, is very unexpected. Man, I can't believe how small this stuff is. Oh, he said he expected to be graduating with $25,000 in debt.
Yeah.
And if the rate increases, he expects to add about $3,500 to that tally. He's studying to be a mental health therapist. Well, you know what a lot of Tyler Dowdens would do? I don't want to leave, I'm 22 years old. I'm going to be $30,000 in the hole. Maybe I won't even go on to be a mental health therapist. I'll do something else. I got to tell you, this is, I don't want to tell the whole story. Through this very bizarre set of circumstances, when I left college, I never graduated, but when I left college, I won a lawsuit for $5,000.
Oh, I remember the story.
Yeah, we don't want to talk.
We won't. Never.
Yeah. But, it was a contingency thing. So I think I wound up with about $2,800, right?
Yeah.
So here, I mean, that's not, it was a little grander when my wife and I got married. Starting off with this, bunch of money.
Yeah.
As opposed to owing a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah.
And when we've talked about this before, I've said why there is not a student movement demanding that there be free higher education, just like there's high school and junior high and the rest of it.
Right.
Because that's what's on a lot of these conservatives' agenda. They're going to start charging you for everything.
Now the movement's going to be about not raising that interest rate.
Yeah. So I'm saying that's too mild. I mean, it's okay and it's good. And I salute these people and they organized. But you know what? It's often better to ask for a lot more. Well, people know that. If you want to.
You get a little less, maybe that's more than you.
So bring 130,000 students to Washington demanding free college education. When they say, where are you going to get it? Say, well, why don't we withdraw our troops from Germany and Italy and South Korea and Japan and Okinawa and places like that? Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to have free college tuition for everybody. And what kind of employment? You'd have to have like an expanded educational system. That would create like tons of jobs, and I know it wouldn't go to Lockheed Martin anymore, and all the Halliburton
all
and
these
all these
bomb builders,
contractors, and people that are supplying
everything,
all the fuel. The United States is military, the greatest consumer of fuel in the world, and
right.
All that. Let me see if there's more in that. President Barack Obama frequently tells crowds that it's important for Congress to stop the hike because one of the most daunting challenges after high school graduation is affording college. Why should that be? You know, I don't remember, but I know when we were mentioning Tom Hartman, the talk show host before, he talks about, he goes to Denmark a lot, and it's free there, you know? And it used to be free. A lot of colleges used to be free in the United States, like the City College in New York, very famous college. Some of you are parents, some of you are grandparents. But, you know, if you're like 18 or 20 years old, ask your parents or ask your grandparents. In the 1960s, a quarter at Wayne State University was $103. Not a credit hour.
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So your bill, your college bill for three quarters would be, a little over $300.
Man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
That's amazing.
With tuition costs at a high, students have been taking on unprecedented levels of student debt. And again, you know, debt is like, it sounds anonymous, but there are people that are getting wealthy off this. This is usury.
Yeah.
You know, this is unjustified interest rates. And so college students leave owing an average of $25,000 in loans, and student loan debt now surpasses credit card debt. You can imagine that. Yeah. Let me see if there's more. Some graduates simply can't keep up with it. A report released Tuesday by the federal judiciary about the court's caseload in government spending year said that showed that the filings with government as a plaintiff has increased. I think I said it doubled. It increased 25% as cases concerning defaulted student loans. Oh, no, surged by 58%. The college students said they worry constantly about the debt. Can you imagine doing that to our young people?
Go right into stressing up mode about things like that.
I mean, what kind of society stresses the people that we're depending on, like this Tyler Dowden, to be a mental health therapist? Well, you know, there's going to be business, more business for them as they stress out. I mean, college is stressful.
Yeah, it is.
And then you got to look at the economy. You got to worry about getting a job.
Right.
You got to worry about all these tests and all this stuff. And then on top of this is this huge debt. So if I have one piece of advice to you and you think, well, gee, it's just me. I mean, find two other students in your high school or in your college or something like that and start a little committee. The East Junction High Committee for Free College Education.
Right.
And, you know, you might be surprised how many people you could bring along. You know who might join? Your parents.
Yes.
Because they're in tough shape, too, a lot of times. Because it's, so expensive. All right. What do you think about that? Free tuition for everybody. In fact, one of the things I ought to have, too, is a big jubilee, is what they call it. Just relieve all students of all debts and let those damn banks eat it.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
On to round three. If a train leaves Spokane...
Schenectady by Saturday.
Correct. March comes before May. What's in my left pocket?
Half a mint and a rusty switchblade.
Correct.
Damn.
Who lets you watch TV episodes and movies instantly over the internet?
Ha-ha! Netflix!
Correct! Watch unlimited TV episodes and movies for only $8 a month from Netflix. See terms of use.
That is rad!
I know. Can you put me down now?
Sorry.
I'm a hugger. Your life is on your computer. Family photos, music collections, email. What if a hard drive crash or virus wiped out those files and you lost them forever? That's why you need Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite backs up your computer files automatically and continually every time your computer is connected to the internet. And after you have a computer disaster, Carbonite makes it easy to restore your backed up files. Plus, you can access your backed up files privately from any computer or on your smartphone or iPad with a free Carbonite app. Start protecting your computer files today at Carbonite.com, because tomorrow could be too late. Unlimited backup is only $59 a year. But here's a special offer. You get a free trial at Carbonite.com. No credit card required. And when you use the offer code PROTECT, you'll get 2 bonus months if you decide to buy. That's Carbonite.com. And the offer code for 2 bonus months is PROTECT.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
Opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. What are you doing there?
I'm itching. I have an itch. Scratching my itch.
I don't even want to say where.
Oh, Peter!
All right.
It's not what you think.
No. Anyway, we're talking about a couple of things. One, our fellow citizens in Mississippi and Alabama, 88% in Mississippi, 86% in Alabama, think that either they believe President Obama is a Muslim, as they say, or they're not sure. But it turns out that Mississippi gets almost three times the federal dollars for every dollar its residents pay in national taxes. In other words, they are an official welfare state, and they're also, dumb as stumps. I mean, they're still voting.
No bones about it.
They're still voting race rather than the economic interest and well-being of their families. And what I said was, if you can't think straight about race and sensibly, and ignore it, essentially, you can't think straight about anything else. You're going to just do dumb stuff. The other thing was about college. Shouldn't anybody think that college shouldn't be free and that students should keep leaving with $25,000 in debt?
At the least.
Yeah. When my wife and I bought a house, my wife had about, $400 or $500 of unpaid student loan that we had to pay back before we get the house.
They wanted to do that.
It was $400 or $500.
Right.
Not $40,000.
Yeah.
So where do we get the money? From the military budget. Bring them home.
Yes.
If you love your Uncle Sam, bring him home.
Bring him home.
Do you know that?
That
song?
I do.
Yeah. Pete Seeger's song sung by Bruce Springsteen. Has a brand new album out.
Yes.
Called
We Take Care of Our Own is this one song.
A single, but all of a sudden I can't. Anyway.
I don't know.
Check it out. All right. Stay with us. God, you people are so impatient.
I know. 313-298-WRIF.
Here's Mike and Fenton. Mike, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
Good.
That Mississippi thing, I think Rocco's probably 88% white and probably in need a chair.
Wait a minute. First of all, can you take us off speakerphone?
Okay.
Sorry to be bossy, but
my wife was listening.
Oh, okay. All right.
Can I put it back on speakerphone?
No. It sounds terrible.
It sounds terrible.
Yeah. So what's your? I didn't get the point.
Rocco.
Okay.
Who's Rocco?
Rocco or Obama? I mean.
Oh.
Yeah, it's right up by the light. She's trying to kill a spider by the light right now.
Who's Rocco?
You get him? Oh, Mr. Obama, the president.
Yeah. Why do you call him Rocco?
That's what I always call him. That's just what I always call him. I don't know why I call him Rocco.
Yeah, me neither. All right, well, good luck on that spider, my friend. Here is, let's see, here's Kirk in Westland. Kirk, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good.
Good.
Well, I wanted to give you some basic facts. You know, everybody's talking about Mitt Romney being Mormon.
Yeah.
I was raised Mormon, and actually, first of all, the Mormon religion isn't even classified as a religion. They're actually classified as a cult.
Well,
so
they classify themselves as a cult?
Well, that's just the way the Mormon, I guess, so much religion is classified as a cult. They're not classified as a real religion.
Well, here is the deal. I have a religion. You have a sect. He has a cult. And you know what I'm saying? You know, that's why my friends, I have two friends that are, now I can't think of it. You just send away and you get a certificate back saying you're a
minister.
Yeah.
Universal Life.
Yeah, the Universal Life Church. So these two friends of mine have probably between them married like 20 people. And they are recognized as ministers. And there's things like the Church of the Subgenius and the Church of Scientology. I mean, they said, hey, we're a church. And
we belong to the Church of the Dyslexic Dog.
Yes. But you know what? Yeah, okay.
And they're also, they're like, their whole thing is, what I perceived is they're like really big control freaks. They, you know, you can't smoke, you can't drink, any kind of soda, anything with caffeine. They even go as far as to tell you what kind of underwear to wear.
Oh, the magic underwear.
What's the deal with the magic underwear?
Yeah, what's
the deal? I have no idea. You know, when I was growing up, my dad wore them. He was part of one of the leaders and everything, and I never, ever, I think, you know, be honest with you, they didn't want you wearing tighty whities because, they felt they were more into, like, big family. You know, they wanted you to have a big family, and they felt that, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it's supposed to lower sperm production.
Actually, I have some magic underwear that says on Home of the Whopper.
What?
Haven't you ever seen those?
What? No, you don't.
I don't.
Peter.
But they sell those as a novelty item.
Oh, God.
A lot of people don't know also is the Mormons were actually the ones that started, I don't know how many people know the Flying J truck stop.
Yeah, sure. I have a friend who used to run one of those.
Yeah,
they owned that for many, many. They were the ones that started that. They have their hands in billions of dollars in companies across America.
I had no idea.
Yeah, Mormons were the ones that started the Flying J truck stop.
Huh.
And of course, it's been sold like a gazillion times. You know,
who knew? Truck stops in Mormons.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, but they have their hands in just.
Well, if you look at it, most of the world's religions have stories that confound our rational sense of what's possible. I mean, even their core stories. And yet when somebody starts a new one, it usually doesn't do well. Yeah, actually, the Mormons have a Michigan connection. They had a colony up on Beaver Island, which is right off of Charlevoix, which I've sailed to. And and people that held that they were a cult, and because they were polygamous, mm-hmm. they had lots of wives. Mm-hmm. This, like a couple hundred good Christian men from Michigan, I think this was like the 1830s or 1820s, went over there and attacked them and killed dozens and dozens of them.
That's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. So that is, you know, I've got a religion, you've got a cult. So
that's just such nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
In my opinion. No offense.
All right, thank you, Kirk. Appreciate it.
I think Kirk sounds like a good recovering Mormon.
Yeah. Here is Mark from Monroe, the home of Fermi 1, 2,
maybe 3,
General George Custer.
General.
Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing
good.
What's up?
just wanted to let you know I've been listening for a couple years now, and you're still pretty much the same douchebag.
Oh. And so are you.
Yeah. We're rubber, you're glue. Everything you say about us bounces off me and sticks on you. You know, actually, I've got a friend who is Mark from Monroe who...
It
wasn't this guy. Because he's...
I do like that word, douchebag, but douchebag. I don't think you're one.
Yeah. No, who, me?
Yeah, I don't think you're one.
Yeah, right. never mind. I'm just telling jokes that I'm hoping... Never mind. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
I don't think of you as a D-bag.
Yeah, we were hoping for a little more refined phone call. Thank you.
Well, I still have to take you to task for some of the things you opened up with about the media.
What's that?
Well, you know, it's just that now we're not even talking about Fox News.
No.
Let's put that out there.
Okay,
sure.
I'm talking about mainstream media as somebody who does, pick up and pursue trends, certain fields of thought, stuff like that.
Okay.
Because if you don't have the internet, that's what you get, plus your show or NPR. Well,
yeah.
You know, and you did get the Congressional Insider Trading thing from 60 Minutes. And I also told you about a program they once had saying how these colleges are basically being set up. You know, these are white guys talking. They're set up or being set up as pretty much an elitist endeavor where only rich white kids can afford it.
Well, that's the way it's going to wind up to be, particularly the more elite ones. Increasingly, they're telling kids, you know, they want to make your community colleges more of like a trade school or something like that.
Right.
So, I don't know. If you ever read this book. It was written, maybe like in the early 30s called Brave New World. You hear it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And, I've heard of it.
And so they had alpha workers and beta workers so that, you know, there was this real stratification. I mean, we've been a lot like that lately, but, between like World War II and way into the 80s, there was this democratization going on, this expansion of the middle class. But the real elite, you know, the bankers, the corporate owners and what have you, you would think they would be happy with it. They were rich during that period, but, they want everything. So what they're going to do is they're going to create this, this sort of Ayn Rand society with this, special elite and then the masses. You know, that's you and me, right? And the rest of us, doing all the grunt work. And, or even the work that before was well paid is going to be paid less and less well, for sure.
Well, remember how you get the young ones to rise to the top. And that's what all these unpaid corporate internships, these political internships in Washington that only rich kids' family can afford to keep them,
right?
For the cost of living in Washington.
Sure.
And then there was one last thing. Now you say you don't watch too much TV.
I don't.
I don't really.
Well, this has been going on for a while, and it's highly insidious. You know, ever since this BP spill and the cleanup. BP has trotted out every black spokesman they could to sell you on their progress and that the Gulf Coast is clean.
Oh.
And then just today, for the first time, I noticed some black dude come on air, a commercial during the basketball tournament, and he was for the Petroleum Association. And basically trying to sell the whole pipeline thing. This is the first time I've seen this commercial. But they really want XL pipeline?
Yeah, they
do. Again, a black face was trotted out there.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Jeez, Louise.
All right, Fred. Thank you very much.
Fred.
Appreciate your call. I think that, and deservedly so, that among most people in this area, Kid Rock has a good reputation and generally getting better. I mean, for the things that he does for Detroit.
Okay.
And he had a big estate in northern Oakland County, like most successful entertainers.
Yeah.
He makes a lot of money. And,
oh, yeah.
That's cool.
And he calls, moved to Nashville for a while.
And he calls himself Son of Detroit. And he's purchased a home on Detroit's east side.
I know. This was really good news. And as the headline says, Kid Rock's house purchases music to Detroiters' ears. Just a few houses down from the Manoogian Mansion. And it has quite a history, this house.
It does. A lot of big parties. In fact, they call it the Barry Subdivision. I wonder if it's named after Gordy Barry.
Or Barry Gordy?
Barry Gordy, yeah.
Is that like a slugger gun?
We won't go there. But, yeah, the Shaneths used to own that. They'd own the Rooster Tail and...
yeah, so there was some party there.
There were some parties there. Yeah, including Barry Gordy. And it's a 6,000-square-foot, six-bedroom, six-bathroom house. And I'll bet you, you know, I could imagine that going for... like $300,000. Yeah.
If it was, everything's
so yeah, because if it was in Birmingham, it would probably go for $2,300,000.
Yeah, right.
So the only thing, maybe we ought to get a hold of him. The only thing I don't understand is why in the world Kid Rock, being a son of Detroit, moving into Detroit, doing benefits for the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, appearing with,
why did he perform at Mitt Romney?
And why does he support somebody like Mitt Romney, who, for instance, won't even support a minimum wage? And if ever a city needed federal support, it certainly is the city of Detroit.
I think it was when Hank Williams Jr. got a hold of him.
Really? I don't know this.
Because he's kind of a right-winger, right? And they're buddies.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Mitt Romney, by the way, the firm he founded is tied into Chinese surveillance. I wonder what the kid would say about this.
I know, and this was a long article in the New York Times.
Did you print it all out? I printed the first page.
I did.
The Chinese government forges ahead on a multi-billion-dollar effort to blanket the country with surveillance cameras.
Isn't this creepy?
And that is like Big Brother is watching you.
Yes, and what they're going after, I mean, the most bothersome part is they're trying to human rights advocates say that they're trying to intimidate and monitor political and religious dissidents. So they're putting cameras in monasteries and
universities, hospitals, mosques, movie theaters, and they've got these centralized command posts. Well,
so Bane.
Guess what American company stands to profit? The one that Romney formed, Bain Capital, the private equity firm that he founded. Now, in fairness, I don't know why it should be, but that he hasn't had any role in Bain's operation for 10 or 12 years, right. But he still profits from it. And it's the kind of thing that if you want to have moral leadership, that you say, look, you make a public statement denouncing this. You say that I'm ashamed. That's why there are firms that, for instance, that will invest your money, but won't do it in what they call green investments, or they won't do it in companies that have sweatshops overseas,
yeah.
Or that have pulled out of the U.S. and all that. So you can do that. You can invest in a way that is a little more ethical.
Absolutely. And also in this article it says that Romney reported in August that he and his wife earned a minimum of $5.6 million from Bain assets held in their blind trust and retirement accounts. So they're still, they have their hands in it.
Right. And Ann Romney says, I don't feel rich.
Whatever. She has no idea what it is to feel poor.
What rhymes with rich?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. People are losing their jobs left and right.
True. Yeah, but this is the riff. Drew and Mike say a lot worse things than we do.
I know. But, hey, when we come back, I want to talk about why am I blocking on the Coney 2012? Coney.
K-O-N-Y. You've probably seen it if you're on Facebook because it's been spamming all over.
And it's millions and millions of people have seen this. And this is this warlord that previously was in Uganda and was just one of these horrible guys with children soldiers and what have you. And I'm really curious about your impression of whether you've seen it. I think they got bracelets out and all of that.
Oh, yeah.
But then more, and if you want to comment on some of the stuff we've talked about already, we'll be back.
You You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Final round time. If two's company and three's a crowd, what's 207?
A bar mitzvah?
Correct. Opportunity never knocks twice. Why not?
It's got sore knuckles?
Correct.
Yes.
How fast does Netflix let you watch TV episodes and movies?
Instantly, through your game console or other devices.
Correct! Watch unlimited TV episodes and movies for only $8 a month from Netflix. See terms of use.
Yeah.
Sir, put your shirt back on.
But I'm excited.
You're scaring the children.
Mike Rowe here with Jim Twitchell, Senior Master Technician for Ford. Jim, a lot of people hear about the works and they figure it's an oil change.
No, Mike, it's not just an oil change.
The works includes an oil change, tire rotation, multi-point inspection, and more. Just $29.95 or less after $10 rebate. Click on the banner now.
What doesn't it include?
That list is probably very short.
Glove compartment, you check that.
Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. See participating Ford dealer or visit FordOwner.com for rebate details through 3/31/12.
Detroit's Rock Station. On the web, thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Rumors spreading around. You like to take the town. Ride the sack outside the games. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls. I'm
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. We are here, and we're ready to get your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. We do have open lines.
We will read some of your emails a little later. Call talkyes at yahoo.com for when the lines are either crowded or if you're bashful. And you go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. Also,
your website.
My website, which is just chock full of interesting stuff.
Amazing.
Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And Occupy is continuing. It's called the 99% Spring. You can find out what's going on. It's going to happen April 9th to the 15th. 100,000 Americans are going to be training for nonviolent direct action against the biggies.
Oh, yeah, just like George Clooney.
What do you mean?
He got arrested.
He did?
Yes.
Where?
He got arrested in Washington, D.C. because he was protesting something about Somalia.
Yeah, he does a lot of Africa
right.
stuff, which brings us to
and
the
his father,
2012.
And there was a congressman from Virginia who also got arrested. They all three got arrested, spent the night in jail on, I think, Thursday or Friday night. And I have to say, good on you, George Clooney. I always kind of like that guy.
Yeah, and the Occupy Wall Street celebrated its 6 months since its start. And
by reoccupying Zuccotti Park.
Yeah, of course,
getting kicked out.
The NYPD just started clubbing everybody and what have you.
Yeah.
And when people just ought to burn their NYPD hats, you know, they're just back to their old brutal, corrupt ways.
It's like wearing, sure. I don't know, it's just wearing any label of any sort still baffles me.
Yeah. Well, all right, Jolene says we should do this. But, hey, Tom, hold on, we'll get you in a second. I did say we're going to talk about this.
You never listen to me.
No, I do sometimes. They're at Coney 2012.
K-O-N-Y. We're not talking about the Coney dog.
Yeah, we're not talking about the Coney dog, although now, oh, yeah, here it is. If you go to Coney, KONY2012.com, there is this, I mean, this is this incredible phenomenon. And some of you that are involved in it like to hear from me because I think there's some good stuff about it and also some stuff coming out that isn't very good.
Yeah,
this film is about Joseph Kony, who is this warlord and was in Uganda because and one of the things that I never talked about, this guy didn't just appear from the sky. I mean, this is the leftover of European colonialism where the continent was looted to support the Europeans. And what came after is usually not been very pretty. Well, the co-founder of Invisible Children, and that's who made this film, Coney 2012, was detained on Thursday out in California for being drunk in public, that's okay, and masturbating, though, and trying to break windows. Jason Russell was allegedly found masturbating in public, vandalizing cars, and possibly under the influence of something, according to the San Diego Police Department. They said they received several calls Thursday at 10:30 a.m. of a man in various stages of undress running through traffic and screaming. Police said Russell, as in his underwear, he was in his underwear. He allegedly took off his underwear at one point, but it was back on by the time officers arrived, said police.
Well, who needed that information?
Well, if we're going to support the butlers in Pennsylvania, the family that got naked, we got this guy, too.
Okay.
Russell's one of the founders responsible for Coney 2012 video that recently went mega viral. He's described as the organizer in the organizer's website as a co-founder and our grand storyteller and dreamer. He's also described as a Christian. He's actually a born again father to children. And his wife, Danica, released a statement that she wrote, Russell has never had a substance abuse or drinking problem, and this episode wasn't caused by either of those things. But yes, he did some irrational things brought on by extreme exhaustion. We can understand that. And dehydration? Yeah, wasn't he in San Diego?
I don't know.
He also took a lot of the criticisms that have been coming out about the film Coney 2012 as very personally. The video, Kony 2012, calls for the capture of the Ugandan, what is that, says LRA, Lord's Resistance Army, that's what it is. And he took,
he doesn't even live in Uganda anymore, for starters.
Joseph Kony doesn't, the warlord.
Right.
Right, exactly. And so that's kind of strange. And there are hundreds and thousands of propaganda posters, stickers, buttons, T-shirts that they're putting in boxes and shipping all over the world, according to Russell, who
had a little episode.
Yeah.
And the other thing is what this video is doing is pushing for
invasion.
Military intervention. And, you know, I don't know. I didn't participate in this and get all excited about it because I knew there was more to the story.
Well,
because there always is, Peter.
What has happened? I mean, the destruction of Africa since its invasion 400 years ago by the Europeans that began slaving and then turning the landmass into colonies. I mean, things like which is now the Republic of Congo, which was called the Belgian Congo. King Leopold was responsible for the deaths of millions of Congolese.
Yeah.
And this is how, you know, you gotta remember, I mean, Europe was ruined by the late 15th century. It was absolutely destroyed, financially crippled. It was, you know, continual wars, madness, religious insanity, environmental destruction, everything that could go wrong with a society that had. And so it got a new lease on life by looting the New World and then looting Africa of slaves, which created this amazing amount of wealth in what became the United States. I mean, the foundation wealth accumulation came through slavery. And so, we tried to make things a little right here, but things never got right in Africa except for a few places because the scars of colonialism and neocolonialism were so immense. And there's just, I mean, it's just mass insanity and there's warlords everywhere. There is, let me see, his name is Kambali Musavuli. He's the national spokesperson and student coordinator for Friends of the Congo. He said today, I spoke with the makers of Kony 2012 years ago, and I asked them if they thought the Ugandan government was doing all it could for peace, and they had no response. And he said that the Invisible Children people are, in effect, backing this very oppressive government of Uganda. And he said, Joseph Kony is certainly an evil man, but he's no longer in Uganda. And this video is pushing for military intervention rather than using diplomatic means because Uganda is a U.S. ally.
It's one of our allies, right.
Yeah. And they've invaded the Congo twice. They've wreaked havoc in Somalia and Rwanda. And Uganda has supported rebel groups, which triggered the deaths of millions of Congolese from which Congo suffers to this day. And Musavuli says, and while this film calls for U.S. military intervention in capturing a rebel, Joseph Kony, by providing military support to Ugandan dictator Museveni, another film, Crisis in the Congo, talks about the role of the U.S. in supporting Rwanda and Uganda's destructive role in the Congo. And this goes on and on like this. He says President Obama is ignoring the law he himself wrote. Instead, for the past 2 years, the Obama administration has given the Congolese army a waiver to use child soldiers in the military and continue to receive U.S. military backing. Why are we backing anybody? Why are we sending any military arms anywhere? Does anybody understand that? This is our tax dollars, right? The video calls on the U.S. to help the International Criminal Court capture Kony, but here is the rub. The U.S. will not sign the International Criminal Court protocols, so it's not subject, and it won't be subject to the court itself, because, you know what? We might have to give up Henry Kissinger for war crimes. We might have to give up George Bush.
Right.
And I mean, that's what they're afraid of. I mean, whether you agree with that or not, that's the fear. Or we might have to, give up people like the Sergeant Bales that did the slaughter in Afghanistan, or the soldiers that have committed these massacres in Iraq. So, I mean, it ain't a good set of affairs. So I'm wondering if any of you have had experience with this Kony 2012 stuff. But on another subject, here's Ray in Dearborn. Gas prices, huh? Ray, what's up? Ray, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was working. Yeah, I was wondering, is it true that we only get 9% of our gas from Saudi Arabia?
We don't. We get the majority of it from this hemisphere. I know that. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the biggest supplier is Canada. We do some domestic, a lot from Venezuela.
So you think there's anything they can do about getting these prices down? I mean, it's a
no. It is
under my profits, big time.
Yeah.
Why? Why you're?
I got a small cleaning business, and I got 5 trucks.
There. Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
I fill up, and it's just. It's killing me.
Well, Ray, I hate to tell you, this might be the good old days. I mean, it has to do really with, and I don't say that flippantly, because it's going to hurt lots of people.
There's several things.
I understand that.
According to Michael Clare, who's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, he says that many immediate factors are Iran's threats to blocking oil shipping in the Persian Gulf, fears of a new Middle Eastern war, and turmoil in energy-rich Nigeria. So, everyone who says that it's Obama's fault needs to look a little bit further into this and,
the idea
there's more factors.
Because what that all amounts to is it's futures and speculation and people that have a vested interest in driving up the price. And like for this pipeline the Republicans are talking about that would go from Canada to the Louisiana
Gulf, right?
To the Gulf. None of that fuel is even, all that fuel would be exported.
Exported.
Yeah. Oh,
exactly. I understand that part. And you guys do a great show. I can't wait till Sunday to hear you guys. So you guys
All right. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Hopefully, we'll get this down.
Prices. Not doing the show.
Right. I just got a new car. I had a 6-cylinder. And I got the same kind of car with a 4-cylinder. I can't believe how much better the mileage is.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Astounding.
I know I've got my little hybrid. I love it.
Yeah. Athena and Sarah getting your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
They open lines if you want to call.
They write in. They said there's a collect call that keeps coming in from an inmate at the Jackson County Jail.
Well, we get that once in a while on the radio, and they call. And it's funny because sometimes they'll say, you have a collect call from, and they'll go, play Metallica or whatever it is, you know. So, hey, you know what? We're glad you're listening.
Yeah,
in there.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Oh, that's right, because what you say is they have a collect call, then I should say Peter Werby.
Right.
But instead they yell,
play Metallica.
But sorry, guys or gals, we can't accept them. Sorry.
I know. Well, we'd get in trouble, but otherwise, if we could, we would.
Here, all the way from the home of Snooki, it's Nicole and Company from New Jersey. Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great. What's up?
Oh, we're chilling. You know, we're not real educated or anything, and we don't want to blame Iran or Obama. We just want to put gas in my Ford, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think?
What do you think? Well, I just think that the gas prices have just gotten ridiculous. And then it's just crazy because 1 week it'll be like 20 cents up. Then the next week it'll be 30 cents down.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
Let me ask Well, let me tell you this. And I said this last week, Nicole. What's going to happen is, like, if the price, say, was, just to make it simple, was $1 a gallon, and ExxonMobil, to sell it to the gas stations, wanted to make 25 cents profit on it, they would sell it to them for $1.25. And they would make the same profit, because if all of a sudden gas started costing them, or, you know, whatever, their product, $1.25, they'd put another quarter on it, and it'd be $1.50. So their profits would always be the same, except what we're going to find out at the end of this quarter. Guess what? All ExxonMobil and the rest of them are going to
make
the
billions.
Yeah, they don't even deal with it. That's millions what they got in their pockets,
right,
when they go out for some fancy dinner. But, Nicole, let me ask you a question. How did you hear this program, or how did you get turned on to it way in the middle Midwest?
Oh, you're going to make me cry. I'm from Detroit.
Oh.
I'm from Michigan in Trumbull. I'm kind of famous around your studio, in fact.
Did you say Trumbull?
I said Trumbull.
She's famous around our studio.
Oh, okay.
Do you want me to tell you where your studio is in Oak Park?
Okay.
Can I say one thing now?
Well, go ahead. We were on a seven-second delay.
I do have to give a shout-out to the Arab that I buy my gas from. Picks up my bar tab every day.
Well, Nicole, you rock out in New Jersey.
I don't
all
think
right.
I understood that.
I'm afraid I did.
Yeah, tell me later.
Here's Michael in Detroit. More on gas, I think. Michael, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. What's up?
Hey, what's up, guys? Hey, I just wanted to just inject a few points here. I think part of the reason that, you know, gas, food, and the like won't go down is because we got to remember one thing that people fail to mention. We're spending a fiat currency. So we're spending a currency that's essentially worthless and losing its value, been losing its value. So everything naturally has to go up.
Well,
it's like until we address
how come sometimes there's deflation?
Yeah, I mean, but you know how did he say it? It'll be first they'll beat you by deflation, then by inflation, and then, you know, the continent that your forefathers conquered, you'll be slaves, basically. So I think that's what it is. It's like, well, ignore the obvious, most pertinent facts.
But wait a minute, Michael. This fiat currency thing is Ron Paul.
This is Federal Reserve stuff.
Federal Reserve stuff. That it's not backed by gold, right?
Well, that's part of it. It's because you got to think of it like this. What is it backed by? With the Constitution, you know, if you go by the Constitution, that's how we have a Congress, a president, judges, governors, and the like, the representatives and statesmen. So if we go by that, the same way they got their power, they swore oath in Article 5 to uphold it. And to uphold it, the only currency that was going to be acceptable was going to be gold and silver. Now, you can have certificates that could be redeemable for gold and silver, but you wasn't going to use a private corporate script in place of legal, you know, money.
Well, they couldn't, you know, how, there's not enough gold in, I mean, there's $14-15 trillion of wealth in the world. There's not that much gold.
Well, when you talk about wealth right now, think about derivatives. We got about 1.4 quadrillion in derivatives.
Right.
So if it's not enough gold, trust me, brother, once Greece and Italy and Spain and all these other places collapse, we insured it. So it's all paper. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I agree. You know, it usually has been. It's what, you know, for some reason they use this word fictive, F-I-C, why can't I spell on the air? F-I-C-T-I-V-E. I mean, it's not real. There's nothing there. I mean, we were talking about this last week. When you say somebody like Bill Gates has got $40 billion of wealth, it's not like he's got $40 billion in currency or $40 billion in gold. What does he have $40 billion in?
That's a good question.
Air.
But where we need to draw the line is what we're doing. We're losing our identity. Like, our children are going to be on the hook for all of this fraudulent debt. And that's what's happening. It's like, if we don't owe anybody, if it's only on the good faith of the people anyway, it's only on our backs anyway, then why don't you have a national currency that is on the backs of the people? Why pay it to a group of people who have undermined you for the last 100 years? I mean, it's almost a joke.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you, I don't see this as the key to the problem. If there was an equitable distribution of the wealth that we all produce as part of an entire society, if we didn't have a military-industrial complex, if the rich were taxed adequately and all that, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. What, Jalene?
If 59% of our taxes that we pay weren't going to that military-industrial complex, which totally POs me. You know, that's the blaring thing right there.
But you got to think about it. The military-industrial complex, Eisenhower warned us, right?
Sure.
So, naturally, what did we do? We went the opposite direction.
Yeah, exactly.
What did we do? We spent trillions. We got 900 bases, troops in 130 countries, no chance fighting wars that we don't plan to win because we make too much money dropping bombs.
Right, exactly. We just got to keep stretching them out.
Wait a minute, Michael. I agree with that part of it. But what I'm saying is the whole thing about fiat currency and fictive wealth and all of that and the kind of collapse of the middle class, the impoverization of more people, the collapse of our infrastructure, terrible schools, this and the, but the country is still the wealthiest country in the world. So what we're talking about essentially is this impacted wealth that has no social acceleration or economic acceleration to it because it's stagnant. It's dormant.
Give me an example. I'm going to give you an example. This, I think, will clear it up a little bit better.
Go ahead.
There's no real substance backing it. So in other words, If you go to the hospital right now and get a 45-minute operation, mm-hmm. that would roughly cost you $15,000.
Yeah.
Now, where in the world? I don't mind paying that kind of bill if I can get a job that will pay me $1,000 an hour. There's no connection to the real profit, the real productivity of the people. The productivity has gone down. We won World War II, and now we can't even make shoes, can't even make shirts. We got to go to China to get our fish. Are you kidding me?
But wait, wait, it's not a lack of competence. That,
it's a lack of...
These people figured out, well, you know, what are the costs of production? One of the big costs of production is paying wages. So if you can get people to work for $1 an hour instead of $30 an hour, the smart capitalist is going to go where you can pay $1 an hour.
But it's beyond the wages. It's about the productivity. We don't even have the productivity anymore.
Oh, so I think we could do
wages
that.
Wages or we not, we don't even do
There's
it
There's that
anymore.
Whole trade thing.
That's the thing.
All right, let's leave it at that for now. I appreciate it. Thank you, Michael.
Email from Terry in Ferndale. We were talking about religion and the candidates. He said the presidential candidates who claimed God told them to run were the quickest to drop out. The more devout, the shorter the run. The most religious states are the most impoverished.
Well, the only thing
he
is...
said we're good workers.
Well, Rick Santorum is still in it all.
He's still...
And he, you know, I mean, increasingly gets...
Nuttier by the statement.
Here is Merle in Taylor. Merle, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You are on the air. Did I do something wrong? I did. Go ahead.
Oh,
you're on
here
the
we
air.
Go.
Yeah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
The whole Coney 2012 thing?
Yeah.
I think he's just mad, man. I think you guys should just give him back his fillet of fish.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Okay. right.
That commercial's so old.
Yeah, I don't think nobody even knows what you're talking about, douchebag. I can't get rid of him either. It's locked.
Oh, it's a.
How did I do that?
I don't know.
Here. Did you do it? All right. But I'm surprised. I'm surprised that we're not getting any response in this Coney 2012 thing. Because,
well, considering how big it's been on Facebook, and everybody's on Facebook.
Yeah, and so are we. You can go to facebook.com/nightcall.
Yeah.
Give us a like.
Yes.
Yeah. And let me do this.
Okay.
Here's the concern of the quality of our currency is something that's always been an item with the libertarian right.
Yeah, especially since
Ron Paul
came
and all
to
those
light,
guys.
Right.
Yeah. And as I was saying, I don't think that's the key of it all. I mean, it's all bizarre. I mean, what is money? What is value? It's all sort of arbitrary. Gold is just has an arbitrary assignment of value. It's a rock.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I know it's rare and that kind of, and people want it. And so it's supply and demand. Talk about inflation. I mean, talk about a bubble for gold. Yeah. All right.
Yep.
So here's what it is. You know, this is a lot, probably not the best radio, but it's important to understand why things are happening like they are in Africa, you know, Congo and Uganda, Somalia, places like that. 1% of the world populations own 40% of the global assets. And guess what? Almost all of us are in that 1% that are listening. Remember that if you go to my website, and it's on the Facebook page too, isn't it? Did you put it there? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Either go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. You put in your income, and guess what? I'm in the 1%. I'm not in the 99%. And, you know, I'll bet you most of you are. And if you're not in the 1%, you're going to be in the 2% or the 3% for sure.
You mean of the world,
of the
not
world.
The United States.
Of the world, yeah.
Because we're in the 99% in the United States.
Yeah, we definitely are. The richest 2% of the world owns more than 51% of the global assets. And if you get down to it, the richest 10% in the world own 85% of the global assets of the world. So so the problems that we're looking at with starvation and wars, and these are usually people fighting for, you know, at a dead end of a destroyed society for the crumbs that exist. And sometimes I'm sure it's just sort of like and this is what I remember talking earlier about what happened in Europe. That's where these endless wars went on in Europe.
Yeah.
30 years war, 100 years war, and what have you. That's what's happening in, you know, in Africa. So, 50% of the world population owns less than 1% of the global assets. And the whole global assets volume is about $125 trillion. So in terms of what one needs for income to have a, as Jolene said earlier, a living wage, it's all there. Mm-hmm. It's all the money is there. I mean, we go to a whole thing. What would happen if everybody consumed the level of an American? You know, the I don't think the planet could take it
right.
environmentally,
that's
but
for
that
sure.
But that's a whole other complex question. But the point being is that you know, there's arbitrary lines. We were talking, we were making fun of Mississippi because what did almost 88% of the people think
question
that,
his religion?
Yeah, Barack Obama's religion. They think he's a Muslim.
It's not M-O-O-S-L-I-M.
No, it's M-O-O-Z.
Muslim, yeah.
L-U-M.
God.
Yeah. And, but also that Mississippi is essentially a welfare state that, although they back, there's Republican ideas of limited government, they experience the largesse of the rest of us. Because in Michigan, we actually, I believe, I'm almost positive, we have a tax deficit. Like, in other words, for every dollar we pay out mm-hmm. in federal income tax as a state, we get back like 97 cents.
Right.
Mississippi gets $2.73.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good
way so
to
we're,
think about it.
So we're contributing to all these Muslim haters and Obama haters. You know, it's our tax dollars going for them.
Did you hear about those bumper stickers?
Which ones?
The very extremely racist ones that refer to the word.
No way.
Oh, yeah. I'll find one for you. Has anyone else seen this on Facebook? I mean, honestly, it's I'm not even going to give it any more.
Well, I hope the people that that have them, they have some really big trucks, because if they got if they got a little car, they could be in some trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, these are people that make the world more difficult for all of us to live in.
True.
It's like they conspire. You know, life is tough everywhere, and because of just the vagaries of it. What can happen, what often does. You never know what card is turning over.
Yeah.
Anything from the weather to individual
problems. One thing that's certain is change.
Yeah. And, I mean, sometimes, a lot of times it's good, but there's also bad things that can happen. So trying to manage life is a real challenge in a way that you're happy and the people around you that are happy.
Yeah.
And I swear, there are people that get up every day and say, how can I make life worse for other people? But they're also making it worse for themselves.
And they don't even realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
it's an epidemic.
Well, yeah. It's what Wilhelm Reich called the emotional plague.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most certainly.
Over 80% of the world population lives on less than $10 a day. Over 20% of the world's population lives on less than $1.25 a day.
My gosh.
Yeah. I mean, how do they do that? You can't even, can you get a water now? Yeah, I think a water costs you $1.25 here.
It's $1.50. Yeah.
Didn't it used to be free?
Yeah, well, it is if you just turn that little tappy on.
Yeah, right, I guess it is. But that's it. The totality of the global assets, world global assets, is $125 trillion. The richest 10% of the world own 80% of this.
Oh.
And, you know, if you began a redistribution of it, it would be, we're not talking about a redistribution.
You're trying to take their money, Peter.
Yes.
Yes, I
am. Yeah, yeah. Because among, I think, let me see, there's $125,000 billionaires that own, for instance, $4.5 trillion.
Okay.
So if you left them with $100 million apiece,
mm-hmm.
there would still be enough money left over to feed everyone in Africa, Asia, and America. So the fact that we have in place the current distribution of wealth condemns billions, not hundreds of thousands or millions or tens of millions, but billions of people to a life that everyone listening would find intolerable, that you would think you had descended into hell. And if you really look at what's happening in a lot of the cities of the world, cities that have 5 million people that you could name probably 10 of them, and I would not I'd be lucky if I knew one of them, because people are, you know, as subsistence farming is ending everywhere, mm-hmm. People are flocking into these huge cities in Africa and Asia,
right.
And Latin America.
And then trying, and then probably struggling on the streets or what have you.
Yeah. But all of these figures, I mean, there's just too many of them. 17% of people in developing countries are on the verge of starvation. But you know what? They're not developing. They're not going anywhere. This is a totally imprecise world. What are you talking about? It's poor countries.
All these different ways of wording things to make it sound nicer.
And just like we say here, this is happening here, where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. They used to say that. In a lot of ways, it really wasn't occurring, because that period from like 45 maybe to 1980 when Reaganomics began. I mean, that's the crux of it. There was a redistribution of income that widened where all that wealth was going. So people that were just the peasants, you mm-hmm. know, your parents or grandparents or what have you, they actually, they could get a house in Allen Park, and they'd have a cottage at Higgins Lake, and they'd get a car and a station wagon. And but you know what? Unless we fight, it's going to wind up back like this. It's going to be 19th century. Let's see. Caller says he's read Coney has been presumed dead since 2009. Says that sending in troops would be a waste of time.
Wow.
Well,
I want to know where you've heard that.
I did hear something about that. But isn't there one of you that has had some experience with this Coney stuff? I mean, I talk to high school students. You know, I teach a Tai Chi class to high school students, mm-hmm. and they all knew this.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of funny how people just get on these bandwagons without even really looking into it further. It happens a lot.
Well, when you see, I mean, the child, you know, the slaughters, the massacres, the starvation, the child soldiers.
Takes over your emotions.
But you know what? There's a lot of energy there, and I don't mean to say you shouldn't be concerned with international affairs. And I'll bet, George Clooney get arrested over stuff about Somalia? Was that it?
Yeah.
I mean, good, great, and great for that young people and older people have been concerned about what's going on in Africa. But one of the things, don't depend on a video, because it's like those crazy videos. I don't even want to name their names, that people are always calling and say, read this.
Yes.
Yeah. Things are usually more complex and deeper. You
talk
get
about
in a video.
Cultish.
Yeah. And also there's a lot of stuff here. So if you have that energy, and I don't mean to ignore people in other countries, and I think George
Absolutely
Clooney is admirable.
Not.
But on the other hand, if you have that energy, and if you got, you know, dozens of kids at your high school or what have you, there's stuff in downtown Detroit. 67% of kids in Detroit live in poverty. And I'll tell you this too. I was talking about this last week, that when I was reading this article about it in Detroit News Online, mm-hmm. and the answer, the comments, they were so disheartening, just filled with racist crap, total lack of compassion.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, who are these people that we're surrounded by?
I know. And I mean, and there's so many of them. It's amazing. In our circles, we just don't know anyone who's like that.
I know.
Except for the few D-bags who call into the show once in a while.
Yeah. We're wonderful.
We are.
Yeah. All right. Your comments. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Yeah.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much, and welcome to our final segment. Be part of it, 313-298-WRIF.
Oh, 313-298-9743.
Well, my guests at 1 a.m., something I recorded earlier this week, is with the authors of a book called Detroit's Cast Corridor. Have you seen that? Did I show you that?
You did. Well, yeah. You didn't show it to me, but you did tell me about it.
And in the middle of it, the Cast Corridor, by the way, if somehow that has escaped your knowledge or memory or something like that, is this district that is around Wayne State University in south of Midtown, Detroit.
District. I love it.
Yeah, and it's always been a student district, a hippie district in the 60s. It was a wealthy district in the 1890s.
You lived there for a long time.
I did. And let me see if I can have a memory. Yeah, Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil did this book on it. And it's mostly this pictorial book. It's actually interesting. It's put out by Arcadia Publishing. They have over 7,000 titles like this. They do a 122-page book, and they have something like, for instance, they have this Armando did the Italians in Detroit, and he did the Irish in Detroit. But you can have ones about city. You could have one, say, the Fisher Building in Detroit. Really? Anything, if you can sell them on it. And, they've got, like I say, over 7,000 titles.
Very nice.
And there was a rollout for the book at the Cass Cafe down by Wayne's. Yeah, sure. I was there. And Armando and Elias sold over 200 copies that one night.
So you have one of these.
In the middle of this interview, without clearing it with them, I said, you know what we should do? We should have a walking tour of the area based around the book.
Yeah.
And they kind of went, yeah. So we're actually going to do this. I'm going to lead part of it.
When?
We haven't set it up yet, but we're going to.
I want to go.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have it on our Facebook page. Facebook, by the way, we like likes.
We do.
Yeah. And you just go to.
We like comments, too.
Facebook.com/nightcall. Yeah, you can make comments there as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to do the Art and Revolution section of the tour.
Oh, very nice,
because they have other stuff. Because, you know, a lot of it has just been removed, so there'll be. Like, you know, what's a parking lot now? I'll say, well, here's where, what was the Charles Lindbergh, home on West Forest, which is now like a parking lot, when the guy that first flew across the Atlantic, and was the first location of the artist workshop, which was John Sinclair and all those people. And, or here's the office of the Fifth Estate newspaper where the MC5 used to be, you were?
Yeah, when we used to work downtown.
Oh, no, this is not there. This is like this.
It's a parking lot,
yeah.
As well?
This is going to be a real interesting tour, right, people?
I'm going to be taking the parking lot with weeds.
And right here was. Yeah. So, anyway, that's at 1 a.m. And then at 1:30, Jeffrey Clements, who wrote this book called Corporations Are Not People. But remember, that's what Mitt Romney said. And that's what the Supreme Court said in this. Finding in this decision called Citizens United, and that's what really allowed the hundreds of millions of dollars from these right-wing billionaires to finance these campaigns.
We had someone comment on our Facebook page who heard that interview earlier this morning because it aired.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and who said that he immediately went to Facebook and unliked Citizens United. So you affected change with one person right there.
Well, I'm sure that guy wanted to. Sell books. What are you?
What?
You have gotten dressed and undressed. Well, not, you know, at least taken off your sweatshirt about four times.
I'm having issues.
Okay.
What can I say?
All right. Let's see. What did, here. Rick Santorum, by the way, has made a campaign promise to bar hardcore pornography.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And how the hell does he think he's going to do that?
Let me ask, do you know the answer to this?
What?
I've heard. I never, of course, never watch.
Uh-huh.
Why does anybody buy pornography if you can get it all free online?
I don't know. Well, maybe some people like having collecting things. It's all.
Yeah, but DVDs,
some people collect Onyx going, elephants. I don't know.
DVDs and CDs, they're going to be like 8-track cassettes.
No doubt about it.
Santorum's campaign posted a position paper with a website that said vowed to vigorously enforce obscenity laws and restrict the distribution of hardcore pornography.
And I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Why would anyone buy like a porn that lasts longer than...
Yeah.
2 minutes.
I don't know. I don't get it. Well,
that's what I want to know.
Yeah. Since the early days of X-rated films, San Fernando Valley has been the industry's home of X-rated films with year-round sound, blah, 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 blah.
You know, a friend of mine works for Larry Flint.
Yeah, the hustler guy.
Out in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And he views porn videos for a living.
You know.
and he loves porn anyway. And I said, dude, this is totally going to ruin it for you. You know that.
Well, not only that, you know that it used to be. I've had, older people tell me that they used to get off on seeing, you know, that porn was like non-existent, say up till the, non-existent, it was there, but it wasn't prevalent really till almost the 70s. I mean, yeah. You really had to go to some dark corner.
Bow, bow.
What?
It's porn music.
Oh.
70s porn music, to be specific.
There you go. So it was, wasn't readily available. And so things like catalogs of maiden form bras.
You're talking about yourself.
No. And, and Playboy, that was, because they showed those bare boobies and all that.
Yeah.
And that was really, but now the prevalence of it is so much, and there used to be a producer here. I can't even think of his name. I would say, now, you know what, maybe I shouldn't say.
Don't.
But there was a producer here that would always have the Playboy channel on. And so this is what Rick Santorum calls hardcore pornography. And the fact that rather than something so forbidden, so exotic, so I don't know what, it was like wallpaper.
Yeah.
It was just there.
Yeah. It was like background. It's like me when I'm on the air and I have the Food Network on. It's the only time I watch TV. Yeah, for sure. You're right about that.
But it's still, they still make a lot of money out of it. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. But now
I actually saw a Playboy yesterday.
A Playboy magazine?
Magazine, yeah. One of our listeners came out to see me and had been somewhere, met a Playboy playmate and got, I don't know. And Lindsay Lohan was in it. I said, I got to see this.
With no clothes in?
Yeah, she put it all out there. Let me tell you.
Did she?
Girlfriend did.
Yeah. Well, one of our former DJs, the famous Arthur Penhallow, he was always sent one every month, complimentary.
Is that why they called him Arthur Pornhallow?
Yeah. No, because he's, never mind. Hi, Art. Never mind.
We love you, Art.
Yeah, we love you, Art. I used to snatch it all the time.
You said snatch.
Are we on the air? Yeah. I didn't even mean that.
Okay, now, do you want me to clean it up a little bit and get back to politics?
Right.
Or are you still going to go on this?
So there's a new ordinance in L.A. that requires actors in pornographic films made in Los Angeles to use condoms. And they're talking it could drive the industry.
That just started?
What do you mean? I mean, why didn't they
before?
They're
just?
Yeah.
Well, oh, my God.
A few people developed HIV.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
You would think that they, oh my gosh, that they've been, this would be in practice for 20 years.
There's most of, on Comcast On Demand, you can get a few porn things. There's
An awfully lot about this.
I heard. No, I actually did watch it. I know guys always say it, but it's fairly boring.
Well, after the first 2 minutes.
Well, I don't even know that. I mean, it's not like, they're like documentaries.
And the problem with some of these porns is that they have plots. They don't need a plot.
Yeah, they don't.
They just need to do it.
Well, on HBO, there are these porno documentaries, and they're hosted by this pert young woman named Katie Morgan. And she's in her early 30s now.
Yeah.
You ever seen her?
No.
And she just comes out completely naked and goes, hi, today we're going to.
Oh, is this great sex or whatever they call it.
I can't remember. But then they had videos of her. She just does these live shows and she walks out on stage completely naked and then the audience asks her questions.
Really?
About the.
Well, you can see, and over in Denmark, that would be no big deal. There would be five of those shows a night.
It does seem.
We are so repressed in this country.
It does indeed.
Now, listen, we got an email from Jeremy in Windsor.
Yeah.
At calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It's kind of long, so I'm kind of breeze through it. He said, as he watched his, and this is exactly how I felt too, Peter, as he watched his Facebook stream exploded with people posting and sharing the Kony, KONY 2012 video. Out of curiosity, he watched it, and immediately alarm bells went off over the oversimplification of the video, as well as the emotional heartstrings he could see it was trying to pull at. This is exactly how I felt. In the end, the video accomplished what it set out to do, to get a lot of people motivated and behind the cause. His problem was that all of the people were willing to throw their support behind an organization and an issue they knew nothing about. They had watched a 30-minute video and were all suddenly veteran social activists. Gosh, you couldn't have said it any better, Jeremy. He says it illustrates a growing problem with what he calls his generation. They'll watch a 30-minute video, click like on Facebook, think they're changing the world. There's a word for this. It's called Slacktivism. Oh,
yeah,
Slacktivism. Most of these same people who watched the video were unwilling to take any time to read the countless articles that he posted, which pointed out flaws with the video and the organization behind it. And finally, he says, it really does scare him how easy it was to get a lot of people to lend their support to a cause that, in all honesty, they knew nothing about. Propaganda is still alive and well, even when masquerading as a noble cause. Bravo, Jeremy. Bravo.
Let me see. Caller didn't want to be on the air. He said, wants to know how Coney is getting funding. Example, how does he fund all the food he feeds his soldiers? Well, I think they did a lot of it by looting and extortion. But again, he's down, if he's still alive, and some people say he was killed in 2009, that he's down to a couple hundred soldiers only. I mean,
right.
They could do a lot of damage and hurt a lot of people.
Yeah, but that's pretty small numbers.
200 mean people with guns.
Yeah, true.
Can do a lot. But apparently, too, you know, they're one of the things you always want to find out, and I think that there are actually websites you can tell, like, if you want to, if you're interested in the environment, you want to, and you get something from the Sierra Club, that you can find out what percentage of their the funds that they get goes for their programs, as opposed to salaries and other stuff like that.
Right, overhead.
Well, this stuff, two-thirds, with this Coney 2012, with the Invisible Children, I think two-thirds of it was going to salaries and movie production and what have you. And, well, you know,
it'd be better if it were a half.
Yeah, well, you know, they made their chops with the movie, so maybe they were doing another. But it is really dangerous. I mean, and Jeremy was absolutely right. If you see a video, what that should do, that should make you go, like that. And then what you need to do is read. I mean, you can check some of the online stuff, but you need to read. You can read stuff online. I mean, some people still read those. What are those called?
Oh, books?
Books, yeah. And read a little deeper about it, because what's going to happen, I'm fearful for, the good heart, the good-heartedness of particularly the young people that took on this issue, whether it's slacktivism or whatever, their hearts went out to the people that were the victims of this Lord's
regime,
resistance army. Yeah. And what's going to happen if they start finding out that they were fooled? They'll go back to this, what's called the ironic stance. That is, everything sucks. Everything is suspect. Everything ultimately is a fake and a lie.
Paranoia will destroy it. Yeah. Remember the Kinks?
Yeah. And so the idea is that you keep an ironic distance from everything, knowing that even the things that sound the best, you know, eventually it's going to be exposed as being corrupt or fake or
right.
something like that. And there are real things. I mean, one of the things to do is to involve, you know, for you to define it. And that is what I was saying earlier about people that were students, that were, you know, like high school students, facing $25,000 to $40,000 in debt if they go to college.
Sure.
Or the idea of, why am I going to do something that's going to come out at such a deficit for me? You know, you're going
to
be.
You might not be able to.
Yeah, you're going to be 22 years old, no 40 grand. Well, I actually wouldn't, you know, you'd have to go to grad school and everything, you know, that much. But, and instead, create your own movement at your own school. I mean, I wonder what three kids in a school in Riverview or Sinclair Shores or you know, someplace like that could do if two or three of you got together and said, can we get some teachers in this for first off, to make sure that this rate that the Republicans are trying to double
the interest rate on student loans.
But even more so, free education. Free college education as a matter of right, just like we expect high school. I mean, does that make a...
Well, I say it's not, it happens around the world. This happens in other countries.
That
college education is free.
Yeah. And also, it is that students are powerful.
In the streets in London.
London.
Have you seen that?
They were going to raise some tuition, and man, they put like 50,000 students out on
the street
in London. And they go, well, maybe, you know, we'll put it off next week.
Right. You know, we were talking about Rick Santorum, and he says he's going to close down the porn industry. Hardcore porn. And so Stephen Farmington Hills wrote, Santorum will have to pry my porn from my cold, dead hands. And with that...
Hey, Google Santorum.
Yeah, just do it.
Yeah, just Google it and
Robbie.
See what comes up. All right, Athena, Sarah, thank you for
so
doing the phones. Angeline Jordan, shall we do this again next week?
I think we shall.
And the rest of you as well. Thank you. And
thanks
stay
for
tuned
in
for the interview. Cast Corridor is next.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, there are, in most big cities, little districts where what sometimes we used to call the hippies, years ago they called the bohemians, where the political radicals and the artists and folks like that hang out. And if you think of the more famous ones, Greenwich Village or the Haight-Ashbury, but really they're in every city. And we have one of our own here in Detroit. It's called the Cass Corridor. And probably generations of people that fit the categories I mentioned earlier, and some folks that just needed a place to live around Wayne State University, or folks that just lived in the area. Well, there's been an incredible pictorial history of it done. It's in a series called Images of America. The book is called Detroit's Cass Corridor. And joining me are the two authors. They're here with me in the studio, Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, you had a just over-the-top opening at one of the current establishments of the Cass Corridor a week or so ago at the Cass Cafe, and you brought your new book, and my understanding was that at the time you sold way over 200 copies?
Approximately, right.
Yeah, and was that a surprise?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wonder, maybe we should do a little geography. Tell us about the Cass Corridor. You know, I actually talked to somebody, I'm trying to think who it was or what their, well, they had been out of Detroit for a long time, and when I said the Cass Corridor, it was one of my guests from last week, that's right, that he had lived in that area, but had never called it the Cass Corridor. Is that a recent name?
I think it's a name that dates from the beginning of the 20th century.
So it has been there, huh?
The Cass Corridor is part of what was always called the Cass Farms.
Yeah.
Which is a stretch of land that started at the base of the Detroit River and went north for about 3 miles, as did all of the ribbed farms, which were how the French divided up the land when they settled it in the 1700s.
And of course, Cass is a famous name, right?
Yes, he ran for president in 1856 and lost. Our only Detroiter who has ever run for that office.
I'm trying to remember whether there's any statues of him around. Is there? I know there's like Hazen Pingree and all that, but there must no Cass statue?
I believe in the Detroit Main Library there's a statue or a bust just of his head, and in Washington, D.C. in the Senate.
Well, this is an incredible, as I said, pictorial history with great captions describing the Cass Corridor from about the 1890s through to the 21st century. What was the impetus for writing this?
I had already written two books about for this Images of America series, The Italians in Detroit and Detroit's Corktown, and I've had a lot to do with the Cass Corridor. I taught years ago at Murray Wright High School down the street, and a number of our students were from that neighborhood. So I had an interest in it. I got two advanced degrees at Wayne State University. I spent a lot of time. But Elias bests me on this one. He actually lives there.
Still.
Yeah, I moved into the corridor about 12 years ago and was always intrigued by what it brought to me as a resident of the city of Detroit. And because of my interactions with Armando, we thought that it would be a great project for us to do a lot more research on an area that was up until that point underrepresented in this series, and it has so much cultural wealth that it was a no-brainer for us to pick up this project and start working on it.
Well, Liz, tell me a little perhaps more in depth, because so many of us that used to live in the Cass Corridor now live in the suburbs, like me. But there's sort of an in-migration occurring, isn't there? There's sort of a revitalization of that district.
There's a phenomenal revitalization that's really occurring underneath the radar right now. I think there is a craving by young people of today here in Michigan for an urban experience. And what's happening is that they've targeted different areas of the city, the Cass Corridor being one of them, to really redefine the area through their presence. And what has occurred in the last 5 years is something that I don't think anyone could have predicted 10 years ago. And it's really an organic movement, and it's really changing the face of the character of the corridor. I think it's all positive, but it's really been a transformation that exceeds any expectations.
The book is Detroit's Cass Corridor. My guests are its co-authors, Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil, and it is published by Arcadia, and it's part of their Images of America. And Armando, tell me a little more that you were starting to. We were off the air about how many of these sort of monographs they have. This is incredible.
There are about 7,500 titles nationwide, and about 150 that are based on in southeastern Michigan. So it's neighborhoods, it's cities and towns, it's buildings, it's ethnic groups, and basically they're all 128 pages and have at least 180 images up to 220. So there's a formula in it that has worked very well for them, and it's very nostalgic. It's basically based on history and delving into the origins of all of these institutions or places.
This is just my allegiance to the area where I still go a lot for entertainment and for food, and friends live down there as well. But is this going to be one of their runaway bestsellers?
We certainly hope so.
there's no doubt. I think that what we succeeded in convincing the publisher of is the necessity to talk about the present as well as the past in this book, which is a departure from their typical formula. So in this book, we talk about the history of the corridor, but we also talk about the transformation that is occurring. And I think that gives it a certain relevance that will increase its appeal to many, many people out there in Michigan and throughout the country who have once called the corridor home.
And we actually had a bit of a tug of war with our editor because, or editors, because we insisted on two of the six chapters are on the present and the future, the looking forward to what's happening. They generally tend to, the Arcadia prefers that we spend time on the past more than the present. But I think we thought that the Cass Corridor story is not complete if you stop at any particular arbitrary point, because it's so ongoing. It's development and it's change. It's always changed, and it continues to do so.
You know, I didn't follow up on what I said. We needed a little geography here for people that need their memories refreshed, or for those who, a lot of people listen all around the world. Where are we talking about here?
Okay, we're talking about the neighborhood directly northwest of downtown Detroit. We arbitrarily made the borders I-75 on the south, Warren Avenue on the north, Woodward Avenue on the east, and the Lodge Expressway on the west. Now, the Lodge Expressway and the I-75 are relatively new. The Ribbon Farms actually went all the way up almost to the Grand Boulevard. But because Wayne State has such an immense presence on the northern end of what's the Cass Corridor, we decided to limit the scope of our book to the area south of it. So it's about four blocks wide at that point and about a mile or two long. But really, the Cass Corridor is sort of a state of mind, and it certainly isn't a small town in the middle of the desert. It stretches.
I was going to say, and you can allow those borders to kind of be a little loose, right? Because
correct.
A lot happened on all different sides of it. Just quickly, Ribbon Farms, that might not make sense to a lot of people. The original, we're talking 18th century, right?
1701, when Antoine Cadillac founded Detroit. He had convinced King Louis XIV in France to allow him to build a fort with a settlement. The Quebecois did not really want a settlement this far west, but he wanted farmers so that they could feed the soldiers and raise crops. So what he did is enticed Quebecois to come live along the banks by giving them farmland. And because of the primitive nature of it, this was complete wilderness. The farms were relatively narrow, but very long, so that they would have an opportunity to all live along the river and be able to ship their crops and so forth.
Interestingly, too, for people that might not realize that a section of Detroit called Black Bottom, which was for many years where the African American community lived, was always thought that it was called that because it was that black people lived there and it was kind of at the bottom of society. But in fact, it had to do with the rich soil.
Right. It was the black soil, not.
Well, I think when people that are familiar with Detroit's Cass Corridor, the name of your book, they would probably locate it directly in the 1960s and think about the MC5 rock band, John Sinclair and the Artist's Workshop, the Fifth Estate newspaper, the South End newspaper, the paper of Wayne State University. But we've got a lot of images in here on both sides, and maybe we could start with the cover. Is this on Second Avenue? Am I correct?
No, that's Woodward Avenue.
No?
Right on the left is the Addison Hotel.
Okay.
Which was renovated several years ago. The parade those people are watching was the diamond or the golden jubilee of the automobile. It was 1946 in July, 50 years after Mr. Olds drove the very first car on the streets of Detroit. He preceded Henry Ford by a few weeks.
So people are all over the roofs of this. And this contrasts, if you will, on page 85, where John Sinclair and the people from the artist workshop and what was called Translove Energy, you can actually see a VW bus in the photo, are on top of a building that's on the John Lodge Freeway. And this, in many ways, the slogan you see there really typifies the era. It was written by Jesse Colin Young of the Youngbloods. Maybe you could read it, Armando, what it says.
The words from the song, "Hey people, now smile on your brother. Let me see you get together and love one another right now."
Of course, if we were to bring it up to modern times, we'd say, "Smile on your brother and sister."
Right. Well, this was the beginning of the revolution.
That's right. My guests are Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil, and they've brought out this wonderful book on Detroit's Cass Corridor. And it is for those of us that have spent any time there and continue to, for instance, it's a good reminder. It's memories, and it's also what the possibilities as well that are occurring right now. But it's of interest, I would suggest, that even if you never set foot in that area, or you were never even were from Detroit. Now, as you said, there's sort of a formula here for Arcadia Publishing that's done. What was 7,500? Did you say books like this?
Approximately, right.
And it's 128 pages?
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's every one of them has usually, except for a couple pages, at least two photos on there. Where in the world did you get all the photos?
Well, it wasn't easy. Many of them came from the libraries. The Reuther Library at Wayne State University was a great resource, as was Burton Historical, in the Detroit Public Library. Another source was
the Detroit News and their archives, phenomenal archives, that they're just most recently starting to tap themselves, and they were very gracious to open up some of those archives to us to access the photos that they had of the area.
Did you know what you were looking for, or did it grow organically? Like, it occurs to me that I would have thought, where do you start? I mean, how did this develop?
Well, we're both teachers, so we know you start with an outline.
There you go.
And
I never knew.
We knew that the periods that were most significant, the 18th century, which was distinctive upper class wealthy people who built their homes in the area. Then early 20th century, middle of the 20th century, when it became what people in those days called the slum. Then the Arts and Revolution, we entitled Chapter 4 because this is the 1960s and 70s. And then the last two chapters deal with the present and the future.
But to decide what photos to put in there was really a challenge because of the formula of limiting.
So you had more than you could use.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, of course, attached to every photo is a very colorful story that we could not capture in such short text here. So maybe that's project number two.
Well, I'll bet, too, because, being both a writer and an editor myself, being on both ends of it, writers hate editors. Mm-hmm. And, of course, mm-hmm. editors have so little patience for writers. Different hats. I mentioned there was an opening for the book a couple Saturdays ago at the Cass Cafe on Cass Avenue at Forest. And it sold a couple hundred books right there. There must have been some people that came up and said, I really loved your book, but how come you didn't have... Did people do that?
Of course, yes, naturally.
I know.
And what's terrible is that as soon as they told their story, we also felt very sad about the fact that this just was such a phenomenal event. But, of course, you have to make choices when you're squeezing all that information into 128 pages.
Well, one of the few things I'd ever quote from Henry Ford, this is the second, he said, don't explain, don't complain. So that's it. Kind of when stuff I've written or when I've published magazines and people kind of complain, I just kind of say, well, okay. there you go. You know, what can you do? Because you guys have done just such a great job of this. And could have this been, you know, double the size? Sure. Could maybe triple, maybe quadruple, because every set of living experiences is just so rich with history, and we're certainly lucky you guys have put together Detroit's Cass Corridor. My guests are Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil, and they're in the studio with me. It's part of Images of America. It's published by Arcadia Publishing. I didn't ask you before, but sometimes the people have a website directly to the book. Is there one? No? Okay. Well, you can go to ArcadiaPublishing.com and find it. But I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and that will take you right to the Arcadia site.
They are available in bookstores,
yeah,
and other stores in the Cass Corridor and actually all through the metro area.
Yes,
so the large bookstores all carry it.
We would invite you to come visit the corridor and patronize one of the bookstores there and get a flavor for it in person.
Armando Delicato, you said you've had a lot of experience. You're older than Elias in the Cass Corridor. Is there anything you found or anything in here that particularly charmed you or that really hit this chord of memory?
I think the fact that it has such distinct personality at different times in history, and yet it's kind of seamlessly turned over. And I say seamlessly with quotes around it because, of course, it was also the scene of a lot of activity, let's say, during the 60s and 70s that was countercultural, et cetera. But nonetheless, the Cass Corridor is really a microcosm of Detroit, and I think probably of some of the best aspects of Detroit. So from being probably a precursor to Grosse Pointe and Bluefield Hills to hitting the bottom in the 1950s as a slum, to nonetheless being a center of such creativity, and really the scene in a lot of ways of the rebirth of Detroit, and I think was very inspiring.
You know, Elias, I was going to ask you a question, and all of a sudden I just had this brainstorm that probably should have waited till we're off the air, but we'll just see how this flies in front of thousands of people. And what I was going to say, as a somewhat younger person, you're living on ground that's already been tread by people, of course, you know,
historic figures.
Yeah, historic figures. And does it pump it up with any greater sense of living than, say, like some place that was invented like 35 years ago?
There's no doubt that there's an authenticity that you feel when you live in a place, in a space that has history behind it. You know, knowing that I'm a stone's throw away from the house where the Dodge brothers lived and maybe created the first car that had the name Dodge is pretty amazing. And to be able to walk and jog through the neighborhood and admire the architecture that was built at the height of Detroit's wealth in the 1920s, both in the corridor and in the surrounding areas, really helps to put things into perspective.
All right, here's my idea and proposal. You guys are stuck. You can't just say, Werbe, that's a stupid idea. So you're going to have to at least agree to it. And then after we get done, you can say, you know, we're not doing that. You know, I was going to say that in posing that question to you, Elias, that if you go like in Greenwich Village, they have walking tours. And you can say, oh, you know, Emma Goldman lived here, or Ernest Hemingway gave a speech here, you know, John, and on and on. What if we set up a walking tour of the Cass Corridor? Are you guys smiling because this is already in the works, or are you loving the idea?
Well, we have so many things in the works. It's amazing what this book has initiated in our minds and in the minds of others. Definitely we would be amenable to walking tours. There are some that are already being conducted by some great groups like Preservation Wayne, which recently changed its name to Preservation Detroit. And we're actually working with a few of the players in the neighborhood to try to create a museum dedicated to the Cass Corridor.
That's great. Well, you know, you have enormous egos when you're in show business, right? Mm-hmm. So I can do it better. I don't know. You know what? I actually don't mean that. I meant that in conjunction, like, for instance, can they show where the Fifth Estate underground newspaper was in the basement of which the MC5 used to practice? That kind of thing.
You are going to be called upon, by the way,
when we get to that point for that, sure.
Yeah, that'll be the programming in the next bar that opens up.
So we still don't know, folks. They may just, as they're walking out, they may be rolling their eyes about it. We'll find out. Well, if this happens, we'll certainly let you know. As I said, Elias, you somewhat younger than Armando, and we were talking about, trotting, and Armando was trotting where people already had as well. So it's not like, that history began in the 1960s or anything. But do you have a favorite photo or a section or anything that really juices you? Or can you imagine yourself walking down and, the Cass Quarter in a different era?
I do. There's a photo of Third Street that's phenomenal, where you see the signs for Weber Furniture, which has transformed into the Furniture Factory.
Oh, yeah.
Anderson Gardens and the Midtown Theater. And there's just a energy, and it's of a bustling metropolis, and it's shown on page 55 of the book. And
okay. We're all...
Every time I jog down that street, I jog down memory lane, even though I never lived it during that era. And my mind starts about all of the redevelopment that has already begun in the area and how it might transform Third to look different in 5 years or 10 years.
You know, the Anderson's Garden and the Willis Show Bar, which was at the corner of West Willis and Third Avenue, they were known for, the Willis Show Bar was known for strippers and what have you, and the Anderson's Garden, for far as we always heard, was where you could get hookers and what have you. But the Willis Show Bar, which was abandoned, and then became the site of something called the Grinning Duck Club, which was where alternative music and plays were performed and, a lot of stuff like that. So this was its busiest. I guess I would look on page 20 and 21 and could imagine myself strolling down Woodward and looking at the David Whitney house, which is where now, where's my memory? Oh, the Whitney. Yeah, that's what it's called. Canfield and Woodward, this ultra-expensive restaurant that you can still go and get a beer for $4 and check out all the interior.
But if you go for lunch, it's really quite reasonable.
Really? Armando, because I'm having too much fun. We're starting to run out of time. A favorite of yours? Where would you place yourself?
I guess I have an aerial map showing Cass Park and looking north that pretty well encompasses the entire area that the book covers. And I like that. Probably, well, it's hard to say. It's like choosing which of your children is your favorite.
yeah.
But it is one of the better ones just because it does encompass everything. It's sort of all-inclusive.
All right, let me look at my clock here. We have about 2 minutes left. So maybe we mentioned that you were in a struggle with some of your editors to not just have it history and nostalgia in Detroit's Cass Corridor, the Arcadia book that usually just does history, but rather you wanted to how it is now and how it can be. So those people that are so far that we've just kind of piqued their nostalgia interest, it's going upward and onward, you think?
Oh, there's no doubt that it is the most dynamically moving neighborhood in the city of Detroit in terms of economic redevelopment. We have cutting-edge environmental or eco-friendly buildings going up. The green rehab movement is huge. We have lofts continually being built in the area. Actually, there's a pent-up demand for housing. There's not enough places at market rate for people who want to move into the corridor right now, and it's an exciting problem to have in a city that does have a lot of abandonment. So to see that energy is something to be excited about.
And there's family housing actually west of the corridor, like in the Woodbridge area. Beautiful old homes that date back to the teens of the last century and what have you. Armando, how about you? You have a forward kind of sense of what's going to happen?
It remains, I think it will always remain a diverse community. There's affordable housing interspersed with housing that is quite contemporary and let's call it expensive. So you've got the entire range in the community, and I think that will remain a part of the Cass Corridor from now on as well as in the past. After the 20th century dawned, the community became quite diverse.
Well, I have to say that even though this book is only 128 pages, it's 85-90% photographs. We've barely scratched the surface of it. It's a wonderful read, great photographs. Whether you were there or not, it's worth taking a look at. It's called Detroit's Cass Quarter. It's part of the Images of America series from Arcadia Publishing. Go to arcadiapublishing.com. My guests in the studio have been Armando Delicato and Elias Khalil. Guys, thanks for being with me, and let's do that walking tour.
Absolutely. Sure thing. Thanks.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If you've been following politics, which lately has only been these Republican primary, you hear a lot about PACs, P-A-C, and super PACs, political action committees, and super PACs. That's where billionaires can just pile on jillions of dollars or say, hey, here's 10 million bucks, go buy some ads. And how did this happen? How did we wind up in a situation where, as Bob Dylan said in one of his songs, money doesn't talk, it swears? Well, here's a book that addresses a lot of those questions. Corporations are not people. Why they have more rights than you do and what you can do about it. And it's the definitive guide to overturning Citizens United. Now, if any of that is losing you, stay tuned, because this is critical to the future of our democracy. And joining me to talk about it is the author, Jeffrey Clements. He's a co-founder of Free Speech for People. It's a national nonpartisan campaign to overturn Citizens United. And again, we'll find out exactly what that is. And to pass an amendment to the Constitution called the People's Rights Amendment. He's represented and advocated for people, businesses, and public interests since 1988. We're reaching Jeffrey D. Clements at his office in Concord, Massachusetts. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here.
Now, let's go over the title, though. Corporations are not people. Now, the Supreme Court says they are, and Mitt Romney says they are. How do you differ?
Well, you know, that's it's a strange title. It's strange that we actually have to make the proposition that corporations are not people. Most everybody gets that and says, of course not. But as you say, Peter, unfortunately, the 5 of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court don't get it. And as we've learned from Mitt Romney and others, there is this sort of, new thinking. It's a radical corporatist kind of thinking, in my view. But there's this new thinking that somehow corporations are just like you and me, and we shouldn't be restricting them in any way, including the spending of billions of dollars potentially in our elections.
Well, your book, Corporations Are Not People, as I said, has one of the subtitles, The Definitive Guide to Overturning Citizens United. Now, that was the Supreme Court decision. Give us a little background on that and what it overturned and or what it permitted.
So Citizens United, the name sounds like a good thing. It's actually a very bad thing. It was a Supreme Court case, January 2010, and the Supreme Court reached out and took this, what had been a rather obscure campaign finance case. And the Citizens United, is the name comes from a not-for-profit corporation in Virginia that wanted to use corporate money, for-profit and other corporate money, in the 2008 election, to attack, at that time, Hillary Clinton being the candidate. Those facts don't really matter anymore, the fact that it was a not-for-profit or that it was about the 2008 election, because what the Supreme Court did in the Citizens United case is reach out, overturn a century of law. For more than a century, we had restricted corporate spending in elections. That's, you know, core American thinking, that corporations are good in the economic area, but they're very dangerous and can corrupt if they are allowed to use all their advantages to spend in the political area, like elections. But that didn't matter to the Supreme Court. In the Citizens United case, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, they overturned all those cases, said that we, the people, Americans, are not allowed to restrict corporate spending in elections, and it specifically struck down the McCain-Feingold law, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, which had continued this important tradition of restricting the spending by powerful corporations in our elections. That's why it needs to be overturned. Big global multinational corporations spending, you know, potentially literally billions of dollars, no way to limit where that money comes from or how it's used. That kind of a view of democracy, it's really not democracy. It can't coexist with the idea of self-government by all of us.
Well, now, this is a First Amendment case, that this was a freedom of speech decision?
That's right. That was the theory of the Supreme Court, that somehow corporations, you can read the case over and over as I have, there's nowhere where it defines what a corporation is. Instead, the court talks about speech and speakers and voices. And my favorite phrase they use, disadvantaged class of person. And so that's, they said all if we try to restrict corporate spending, it violates the corporate free speech rights. And, you know, most Americans, I think, know that speech is something humans do. The free speech is one of our core amendments in the Bill of Rights, which are really about human rights, how we protect our freedoms. And they've just been taken by the biggest corporations in the world in that case.
Well, Jeffrey Clements, I agree with what you've said and the adverse effect that this injection of huge sums of money, how they distort the political process. But could you look at it that this devil's advocate stuff, which many of my listeners think I am anyway, we have the First Amendment. If you're in Canada, if you're in West Germany, and if you make anti-Semitic or anti-black remarks, you can be prosecuted. Here, you can do that with impunity because we don't want to restrict speech. We're very, as you said, jealously guard that right. And I can call for revolution or anything under the sun. So how inconsistent is this with the First Amendment? I mean, I wish it wasn't there, and I agree with what you're saying, but could it be terrible and consistent with the First Amendment?
No, not in my view. And here's why. At first, the group I co-founded on the day Citizens United was decided is called Free Speech for People for a very important reason. I am absolutely not suggesting in any way that we limit speech or free speech. Especially in elections, we need robust freedom to say whatever we want to say. The problem with Citizens United is it's masquerading as a speech case. What it is, in fact, is a corporate power case. It was a regulation that only applied to corporations. It did not apply to human beings. It did not apply to speech. It applied to corporate money. And that is why it is so dangerous, is because if we think it's a speech case and we are limited in our response to this radical notion that somehow now global corporations can spend anything they want in our elections, we are going to be in real trouble. But if we actually look at it as what it is, nobody is usually a free speech case is decided. It might make you really angry, the flag burning. So somebody has a right to burn a flag. Makes me angry. It makes a lot of people angry. But you get, that's some human being who is expressing himself, not in a great way, but he's expressing himself. You get that, and you understand that, even if you're angry about it. Think about this case. Who has a freer speech now than before Citizens United? Nobody. No, in fact, we have less speech now because it's dominated by the very wealthy and the corporations. So there's not a single human being who's any freer after the Citizens United case than they were before. It's simply, except, now CEOs who had already plenty of freedom of speech and the law had not restricted anything they wanted to say, now can use the general corporate treasury funds to basically distort the election for a corporate interest rather than a human interest. So it's really not about speech at all. It's not, trying to overturn Citizens United and say, we actually should go back to what we had for 200 years, the right to regulate corporate spending in elections. If we do that, there's not a single idea that gets suppressed. It's not biased towards any party or point of view. It's not like we're trying to limit speech we don't like. It has nothing to do with speech. It has to do with these powerful creations of government, really. Corporations are creations of state law. They're not people.
Mm-hmm. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Jeffrey Clements, he's written, Corporations Are Not People, Why They Have More Rights Than You Do and What You Can Do About It. The Definitive Guide to Overturning Citizens United has a foreword by PBS's Bill Moyers as well. You can go to corporationsarenotpeople.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, peterwerby.com. And Jeffrey Clements is co-founder of Free Speech for People. And am I right? It's just freespeechforpeople.com?
Dot org
it is. Okay, because it's an organization. Right. Well, let me continue challenging you, and that is that one of the arguments is you've only mentioned corporations, and we think about people like the Koch brothers, David and what's his brother's name, of the two billionaires that fund the Republican.
Yes, I know exactly who you mean.
Yeah. And
the name of his brother's escaping me, too.
Okay.
The Koch brothers, they're often referred to.
K-O-C-H, not
right.
C-O-K-E, people.
Right.
It's K-O-C-H. Google them. It's amazing. But in any event, what one thing, Jeffrey Clements, that you left out of the equation was unions. So I belong to a union, and although my union doesn't do as forbidden by its charter to do anything political because of the nature of our work. Other unions, say like the UAW and the AFL, are going to spend tens of millions of dollars representing the interests of union members and working people. And couldn't one make the argument that corporations are doing the same thing? The Koch brothers, although they're billionaires themselves, and they back the Republican Party and the far right because they want to increase the profits of their wealth and their corporations, which has stockholders. So through that, just like the UAW or the AFSCME or the SEIU, union like that is representing its members by being able to contribute large sums of money to the political process. The corporations are doing no differently. That's a good argument.
Well, it may be a good argument, except it's wrong in the most important sense.
Good. I'm glad.
Which is that, they're not doing the same thing and they're not the same. But I want to preface that. I will get to that. But I want to say, first of all, I think the important issue is corporate power, and that's true whether unions incorporate or it's a for business corporation. But it's really people have to remember the law that the court struck down in Citizens United, the McCain-Feingold restriction on spending in elections by corporations or unions. It's actually applied to unions, and it has done so since 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act. People tend to talk about corporations, A, because that was the issue in Citizens United. It wasn't a union. It was about corporate spending. And B, because people know that, the union problem, if it's a problem of spending in elections, is nothing compared to the corporate problem. But if someone has a problem with union spending in elections, they should be worried about Citizens United, too, because according to the court in Citizens United, there's nothing you can do about it to limit union spending. But then let me go to the core of the issue, because, first, the People's Rights Amendment, which I advocate as a constitutional amendment to reverse this case, would not just pick on corporations. It basically says that these rights are human rights, and we go back after we win this amendment, and Congress and the states will have a good debate about whether union spending and corporate spending should be both limited in elections. But, we should not pretend that this is an equivalent issue, because it's not. First, something like 7% of the workforce, the private workforce in America, is a member of a union right now. The resources, and it's higher for public unions, no question, up around 35% for public sector workers. But the amount of money that is available to corporations just absolutely overwhelms the amount of money available to unions. And there's a reason. Unions mostly are people. It is the money they get is from collecting contributions from the union membership.
Dues,
exactly. There's only so much of that you can do, and you're collecting it from, the working people who've had their wages hammered down for the past three decades because of this corporate power movement that we've confronted, and that Citizens United is kind of the end game of it. That has a very limited ceiling. You can only get so much of that. The corporations, on the other hand, we've got to remember, Walmart alone had $421 billion in revenues last year.
Huh.
It is just, the amount of money is staggering. The second thing is the kind of money it is very different. Corporations, let's just take one example, News Corporation, right? It's a global company. They sent $1 million to the Chamber of Commerce and another $1 million to the Republican National Governors Association to interfere in the 2010 elections and try to, get candidates that would help News Corporation's bottom line. The number two shareholder of News Corporation is the Kingdom Holding Company of Saudi Arabia, with $2 billion of shares in News Corporation. That, and they own the decisions News Corporation makes about spending its money is based on the profit motive of News Corporation by definition. That's what they need to do as a corporation, answer to the shareholders according to corporate law. I'm not sure that's a good idea, but that's corporate law. That's a very different agenda than the union agenda, in my view. But again, the bottom line is we should be able to have that debate and decide on those rules in a democratic process, with all Americans being able to, weigh in. And if people
sure.
think unions are a problem in elections, we can address that. But what the Citizens United Court does is it takes that right away from us. We're not allowed to have that debate. We're not allowed to do anything about corporations or union spending in elections.
Well, I guess I would say that corporations shouldn't be allowed to interject that kind of money into our elections. And the unions, our unions, my unions, shouldn't have to do that. And in many ways, if a union said, well, gee, I want to take that money and use it for benefits or reduce dues, or I want to use it for organizing efforts, and we're not going to put anything into the political process, that the other side would have a free ride. I mean, it's the unions are virtually forced to enter this process with millions of dollars of member money, right?
That's a really good point, Peter, because I think, you know, that is the problem that we are facing right now in our country, is that you're nobody if you don't come to play with a huge checkbook. And that's why most Americans are frozen out of this process of democracy and elections, that you have to, if you want to have a chance of having anything you believe in, getting any kind of, you know, hearing at all, you better have a whole lot of money to come to the table. Yeah. And that's not what, you know, citizenship and government of and for and by the people was supposed to be. And I think you're right. You know, unions are beleaguered already because of, you know, corporate power, you know, driving down. We used to think of pensions and rising wages as a good thing, and now, you know, it's often viewed as somehow a bad thing, that it's anti-competitive, that we have to drive down those costs, so-called, and drive up shareholder wealth. But, you know, unions, I think you're quite right. If they're forced into it, and we have to clean up this system, and we have to get back to some kind of, you know, approximation of free, fair elections and a responsive government that actually listens to the interests of the people rather than to those who have massive amounts of money to spend on them.
Listen to the Peter Werbe Show. My guest, Jeffrey Clements, he's written, Corporations Are Not People, Why They Have More Rights Than You Do and What You Can Do About It, The Definitive Guide to Overturning Citizens United. That was the Supreme Court decision in 2010 that said corporations could contribute whatever they want. We've seen that in these super PACs that have taken place. Now, I don't suspect that you think there was some golden age before January 2010, because there were, I can't remember the author, the book, and I hope we don't both of us draw a blank again, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was the name of a book, and that was probably written in the mid 2000s. There's always the interjection of big money into, politics and elections.
Yes. And you know, there's been some really good books on that issue, and another one out right now is Republic Lost by Larry Lessig, covering the problem of money in politics and the history as well. No, I certainly don't think there was a golden age. You know, we've had a serious problem of money in politics, at least since Buckley versus Valeo, a Supreme Court case in 1978 that struck down key features of what was an attempt at the time after Watergate to limit the, you know, bags of cash and pay to play kind of politics that were going on. And part of the reason we can't address the problem is that Supreme Court thinking that started in the late 70s, that somehow money is just the same as speech, that we can't limit independent so-called expenditures, independent spending. In other words, not a direct contribution to the candidate, but something that the Supreme Court pretends is independent, like the super PACs and the PAC money that we're seeing now. And it's obvious to everyone, I think, except the Supreme Court, that to consider those PACs independent of the campaigns is naive, to say the least. But we can't do anything about it, not only because of Citizens United, but because of this thinking that happened in the Buckley case that struck down individual limits on that kind of campaign spending. So, and then of course we have the lobbying that goes on in between the elections, which is just a massive amount of spending, by directly interested parties. So, you know, military contractors will spend a fortune on lobbying to get million and billion dollar military contracts and many other examples. That's just one. You know, the energy companies, of course, oil and gas, are going to spend a fortune to get special tax breaks and benefits for their corporations and so on. And so that is a big problem, and it will be a big hill to climb to fix it. But if we don't begin. We could say goodbye to democracy. And what the Supreme Court has done is essentially said we can't begin. There's nothing we can do about it. And that's why what's at stake is really just not campaign finance or money in politics or all of those sort of policy issues, which are hard enough. What's at stake is who makes the rules in this country. Is it really true that, as the Supreme Court says, that we Americans don't have the right or ability to try to fix these problems? That's what the Supreme Court tells us. That's why we need a constitutional amendment.
Well, I want to talk about, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you only because this is why Jeffrey Clemons wrote a book, because trying to squeeze this all in is tough. By the way, the best democracy money can buy was a book by Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T.
Right.
And it's 10 years old, and I guess I don't remember because I interviewed him about it, but it was a while ago. This Corporations Are Not People is a brand new book by Jeffrey Clemons, and you're advocating a people's rights amendment. What form would that take? I mean, the constitutional process, the way the other ones have made it?
That's right. So we've amended the Constitution 27 times. 7 of those times have been to reverse Supreme Court cases where they went off the rails. Remember the Supreme Court ruled that in the Dred Scott case, that African Americans can have no rights in America. They ruled that women can't have the right to vote. They ruled that we cannot have a progressive income tax in this country. Imagine being the folks who had to do the constitutional amendment to have an income tax. Right. Well, they did it, and they succeeded in the progressive era. And, so that is, it's a basic tool of American democracy that when everything's on the line and we're really facing a choice once again, is this experiment in self-government and freedom and democracy actually going to work? Often we have to go to the amendment tool, and that requires a 2/3 vote of Congress and a ratification by 3/4 of the states. And to make that happen, of course, requires a broad national movement in the states, in the cities and towns. And that's happening across the country. It's really picking up steam.
Well, why would, I'm going to have to get some shorter answers. I mean, your answer has been great. I don't mean that, but I just want to get a few more in. Why would anyone in Washington that's a recipient of the largesse of the corporations, and some Democrats are, to be sure, many of them are, including President Obama, or getting union money, why in the world would they want this? I mean, why break a system of which they are the beneficiaries of?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it absolutely affects both parties. Nobody is innocent in this. And the reason they will is only when we insist that they do it. The all-male unelected senators at the turn of the century did not vote to have women have the right to vote and we the people be able to elect senators, which we didn't used to do, because they wanted to. They did it because the country insisted. And so that's what will have to happen this time. There's already, though, amendment bills in Congress being supported by Congress people. The People's Rights Amendment, introduced by Jim McGovern, congressman from Massachusetts, has a Republican co-sponsor, Walter Jones of North Carolina. So there's some leaders stepping up, and I think they will, we can't be naive. They won't do it, won't get 2/3 of a vote in Congress without a real, rising up across the country and insisting. But we're seeing that actually happening now with resolutions, cities, towns, and states happening right now.
Well, that's great. We have about maybe a minute left. The idea of how would these election campaigns be financed? For as far as I'm concerned, you could have 2 weeks for primaries, 2 weeks for electioneering, and boom, go vote.
Yeah, there's a lot of ideas. Once we get the power to actually make the rules again, the people, I think, will come up with some good ideas, from short campaigns like that to public financing ideas to help people not be able to run for office without, begging from the very wealthy and corporations. There's a lot of different approaches we could do to clean up this system. But until we get the power back to do it, that's the problem. So that's why we need the amendment. And then I think there's a whole bunch of really good ideas, from disclosure to limits on spending and so forth.
Well, absolutely. This is important stuff. I mean, if we're serious about democracy, you got to take a look at this book. The author is Jeffrey D. Clements. Corporations are not people. Why they have more rights than you do. And what you can do about it, there's a foreword by PBS's Bill Moyers. And it's called The Definitive Guide to Overturning Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision that allowed all this money to be thrust into the system. You can go to the website for the book, CorporationsAreNotPeople.com, also my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and FreeSpeechForPeople.org. All that will be on my website as well if it's going by too fast for you. Jeffrey Clements, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. Great to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Now, more Riff Rock.
It's on.
On the Riff.